Prayers to order July 20th, Wednesday, 2005. I'm going to be with you about 6.5 minutes before Representative Boquist takes over, and I'll come back periodically from the Speaker's office as I'm able to. Open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 1083A.
Bill Taylor.
Yeah, I can run and go see if he's on his way. Okay. We'll stand at ease a minute here and see if our committee administrator can show up.
He's not here.
Supposed to have the news maybe by this like 2 o'clock to get this one done. We're going to pick off some of these easy ones.
Okay, the men will be by 2 o'clock.
Yeah, go ahead and mark them off.
Okay.
Bill Taylor gets here. I'm going to go ahead and have Cletus Moore just read the top of the staff summary, and I want to get right into some testimony from the representatives to free them up.
Okay, Cletus. Mr. Chair, Committee SB 1083 creates credit against personal and corporate income tax liability for increased labor costs associated with annual inflation-based increases in Oregon's minimum wage. Limits credit to employers in farming activities defined as crop, livestock, and horticultural production. Explicitly excludes forestry, with the exception of Christmas trees, stabling esquins, breeding greyhounds, racing, and aquatic species production from credit eligibility. Allows credits to be carried forward for 5 tax years, permits taxpayers eligibility for credit to sale, credit to other taxpayers with Oregon tax liability. Authorizes the Department of Revenue to establish rules for marketing tax credits, becomes effective with tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2006, sunsets following 2009 tax year. Eligible credits may be carried forward beyond sunset date.
Thank you. Representative Schaffner and Representative Kropp, please.
First?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Delighted to see you here.
Well, I'm sure.
Any comment, Representative Clark?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thanks for just taking a few moments to hear my hearty approval of this direction, Senate Bill 1083. I appreciate Senator Schrader in bringing this concept forward. I'm a fifth-generation Oregon farmer. And I got to tell you right now, this is, I'm a primarily a grass seed farmer, and I will tell you that the yields that we're having right now, and I will leave here in a few moments and go help my dad combine what's left of our crop. are horrendous. Since 1968, which is the last time we had a significant rain event during harvest, which damaged our crops, I have not seen such a bad crop in the grass seed industry. Now, there are other segments of agriculture I think will do well, row crops and so forth, but I will tell you, us grass seed farmers right now, this is a horrible year for us. And I will tell you that this bill is going to be ever more needed this year than perhaps any year for a number of reasons. As you know, the voters have passed a bill that mandates the increasing every year of the minimum wage. And in agriculture, you know that we just can't simply pass those costs along to the marketplace. We often say, sort of jokingly but sadly, that we in agriculture are price takers, not price makers. And that's really how agriculture works. We are in a global economy. We're not competing with the farmer down the street. We are competing with some farmers in Idaho who have a much lower minimum wage than what we do in Oregon. And as those disparities in the wage differences between states like Idaho and Oregon exist and grow, it creates this tremendous imbalance. And the dynamic it creates there is that some of the crops grown in Oregon that are very labor-intensive, that provide jobs for farm workers, some of those crops are simply going to migrate to some place that can pay them $3 an hour less. Now, I was out picking blueberries in my blueberry patch at home the other day, and you know, I'm a big believer in mechanization, but I don't see how you can mechanize the picking of blueberries. And that means that at some point in time, as the costs of hiring that labor continue to escalate, we get out of sync with, we cannot compete with states like Idaho. Crops will move there, jobs will move there, and I don't think anyone really wants to see that happen. The other thing is that because we are in a global economy, and we in Oregon have experienced this with, I'll give you the great example of Chilean pears. It was an example where subsidized pears were dumped into the United States of America, which has subsequently been ruled against, but frankly created a damaging effect in the marketplace. We've not been able to recover from that in the pear industry as of yet. What that means is that we have a global economy. And when we have a global economy, we have to compete against other nations that have a much different viewpoint of regulatory issues and wages and all of those things rolled into one. So that's why this bill is important, to help agriculture, which cannot pass our costs that increase along to the marketplace. The marketplace will simply not bear it. If Fred Meyers, no slight on them, they're a great Oregon company, but if they want to...
Not anymore, they're not.
If they want to offer a cheaper product, they will buy it wherever they can source it from in the world cheaper. And if Oregon products do not fit on their store shelves because they are not competitive price-wise, they simply won't be there. And that, again, means more Oregon family farms like mine and others going out of business. This is a tax credit, I would remind you. And that means, of course, that to use a tax credit, you have to make a profit, right?
Well, I can tell you this year,
for some of us in the farming industry, it's going to be pretty tough to make a profit. And in fact, I would be very happy, even as a small farmer now, that if I could just break even this year. So there's a piece in this bill that I also think is very important, and that is allow the sale of the tax credits to someone else. And that is a very fair way of helping a farmer who does choose to grow crops that require a lot of labor, which again provides employment for people and adds revenue to the state's coffers, that if that person is going to be losing money, then at least there's an opportunity here for a tax credit to be sold to help them stay in business. And that is a part of this bill that I think is an important part. And I'd like to heartily add my approval to this bill, and I would hope that you would indeed pass this bill forward. I think it is a very fair idea, and I think it's a bipartisan idea. I have my friend here from the Democrat Party who is very much in support of this bill, and it passed the Senate 25-4. And I think that's also significant that senators from all over Oregon, including the urban areas, recognize the realities of this bill and the need for this bill, of that agriculture cannot pass its increasing costs on to the marketplace. And I appreciate the fact that the senators saw the wisdom of that. With Mr. Chair, I will be quiet.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, thanks for having us. Mike Schaffler, Happy Valley, Southeast Portland. A couple years ago, I was on the Business, Labor, Consumer Affairs with Representative Garrard, and we went through some painful hearings about getting rid of the cost of living adjustment to minimum wage. And it was doubly painful for me because I am a wholehearted, absolute, complete supporter of minimum wage and cost of living adjustments to it. Yet at the same time, my parents grew up on dairy farms. Both my grandfathers were dairy farmers. My cousins are dairy farmers in Minnesota. I grew up in Iowa working in the fields with my friends, with my neighbors. I was a farmhand. I got paid minimum wage. But I got to know these folks, and I know they work really hard, and I respect them. They provide us with food and everything else that we need to survive. And one of the things about this, and Representative Krupp said it very clearly, these folks, the cost of everything is going up. Unlike a tavern owner or a restaurant, they can't add a nickel onto their product, or a retailer. They can't do it. They're at mercy of markets in Chicago, New York, and Tokyo, and that's not going to change. So I asked myself, how can I help these folks? How can I help this huge sector of our economy, give them some relief, maintain minimum wage and cost of living adjustment all at the same time? So I had a bill 2 years ago that would give them a tax break. And it's turned into a tax credit that can be sold, and that's fine. I support that completely. But I do want to tell you what this is not about. This bill is not about keeping people at minimum wage. That is not what this is about. That was not the intention of this. That's not the goal here. I was a farmhand. I started at minimum wage on a farm right after I graduated from high school, as a matter of fact, right after I got done being a lifeguard that summer. And I ended up not getting paid minimum wage. I got a raise because I stuck it out. But this is not about keeping people at minimum wage. A good hand is going to get a better wage if they're going to be there full time. A lot of these folks are migrant workers. They come up here picking the crops, and then they're gone. A lot of them folks are never going to get any more than minimum wage. That's just what the market can stand. I didn't make it that way. That is reality. This is not about keeping people at minimum wage. I don't believe a good worker will stay at a minimum wage because they'll go down the road and get a job where they're going to get more than a minimum wage. This is about providing relief to farmers and ranchers who have to bear this burden that I've voted for and support, yet they cannot do anything in their line, in their sector of the economy to add on to the price of the crop that they sell, the product they sell. They can't do it. So that's what this is about. That's why I support this, and I really appreciate you having me. Good bill should pass.
And, Mr. Chairman, one final comment on my part, if you would allow me, is I won't declare a potential conflict of interest here, even though I'm a farmer, because I don't hire any employees on my farm.
No, I got somebody coming up shortly. Okay. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe, I don't know if you can even answer this, but I when you talk about selling a tax credit, what would a tax credit sell for if it's worth a dollar?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Barker?
80 to 85 cents.
Probably discounted 80, okay. 85 cents, something like that.
And then another question, maybe you're not the people to be asking, but if I may call it. There's other people are going to mean, so gee, this is really bad because if a farm worker is getting paid $10 an hour, the farmer will not get any tax credit, therefore they'll never pay the farm worker $10. If they're paid over minimum wage, the farmer will not be able to get the credit. Farm Bureau is telling me that's not the case. Do you know?
That is, Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, that's my understanding also.
That if somebody can get paid more than minimum wage, the farmer would just get the portion that applies to the minimum wage increase.
I believe
no,
that's...
No, Representative,
Representative Barker, we're going to have Paul Warner up here in a minute from the revenue side, and he and Deborah Buchanan can answer those questions.
Okay, thank you. I'll wait. Thank you.
You're off the hook, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to have Paul Warner and Deborah Buchanan come up. I know Deborah's not prepared, but she can just sit there and answer any questions that need to be answered. And Paul, if you would, kind of give us a revenue review of this and the mechanization of it.
Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. This bill came through the Senate Revenue Committee, where we did the revenue impact analysis on it. And the way we calculated the revenue impact, and I think you've got the statement there, we estimated in 0507 it would be about 1.25 or 1.3 million. In 0709, about 5.3 million. We've estimated that there are about 10,000 workers at the minimum wage that would be eligible for in the agricultural sector. We adjusted that down a little bit about some of the restrictions there you saw on stabling, for example, greyhound racing and so forth, but a fairly small percentage reduction from the ag base. We have interpreted bill to apply to increases in the minimum wage that are attributable to ORS 653.025. That's the indexing part of the minimum wage. So that to be eligible for the credit, you have to be in farming activities and you have to have a wage increase that is caused by that indexing. So in other words, the increase. We're currently at 725. As a minimum wage for the 2005 year, we project that will go to 740 in 06. So that 15 cents times the number of workers eligible, which would be the workers at the minimum wage, the hours that they work, is the estimated wages we think would be eligible for the credit. That turns out to be about 3.1 million. And then in your first year, it's a 50% credit. After that, it's 100% of the wage increase attributable to that indexing. There is another portion of the language there that says that it is employers who are employed in an hourly rate that equals or exceeds the hourly minimum wage. We have interpreted that to be, for example, a worker say that's at currently at $7.30 an hour. Next year it would go to $7.40, so that 10 cent piece would be the part that would be eligible for the credit. So you could be above the minimum wage, but if the indexing pushes you above where you are now, that increment that pulls you up could be eligible for the credit. I believe another question, Mr. Chair, was on the marketability. We have, and Deborah may be able to comment on this because the department will establish some rules, but we have worked with this concept a little bit. With Bendit Care Facilities, for example. And typically what happens is you have a broker who will acquire these credits and then will sell these. And usually, I think my understanding is 80 to 90 cents on the dollar, depending on the market and how liquid it is. But obviously the purchaser of the credit has some tax liability, and they'd be willing to get a dollar's worth of credit for something somewhat less than a dollar.
Question, Representative Barker.
What if the farm worker is getting paid $10 an hour today? What happens when the next shift comes along?
If a farm worker is making $10 an hour today, and there's an increase from 725 to 740, my interpretation of the bill would be that you could not, any increase you would give them would not be directly attributable to the ORS statute related to indexing.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Yes. Mr. Warner, you were using some figures related to, if I follow it right, were based on subsequent or future increases in minimum wage. We've had, of course, some cost of living adjustments already to the minimum wage that was enacted by the initiative. And the language of the bill is attributable to increases in the minimum wage required by law. And I'm just wondering, is it true that it's only future increases that you valued, and how would we know that for sure based on the bill language?
I've discussed this with council. I think the key language there is increases in the minimum wage, so that you have increases on a section 2 there, 2 sub A, where tax years being on or after January 1, 2006, before January 1, 2007, what are increases during that period in the minimum wage that are attributable. And the key, I think, is increases during that period, and that would be the annual increase due to indexing.
Okay. Further question, if I could. I see that the operative sections, it's section 2, sub 2, A and B, which have the 06 piece and then the 07 and forward piece, refer to paid for employment in farming or ranching activities. And then the definition over the next page is farm use. It doesn't say anything about ranching, and it doesn't use that same language. And I'm just, is there something I'm missing here, or is there a disconnect in the language that probably ought to be fixed?
Representative McPherson, the bill was amended in the Senate to narrow some of the components of I don't have the statute list, but the original bill had referenced the statute on what farm and ranching activities were. And so what what the new version, what the Senate version did was refer to the definition of farming and ranching activities and then spell them out exactly what they are. And most of this language is taken from current statute. There's just several things that are left out that the Senate didn't want to have included. And our estimation is it's a very small percentage of what is currently in statute.
I'd like to direct this question to council, if I could. Council Taylor, this looks to me like there's an inconsistency in language, that the operative language says farming or ranching activities, mm-hmm. and the definition then is farm use.
That's correct.
And it seems to me that the definition of farm use doesn't clearly, probably since they're in the same bill, one would assume that it's intended to be the definition of what's farming and ranching, but it doesn't, it seems like it ought to say that.
Chair, members of the committee, Representative McPherson, I think what they probably intended was farming with this definition. I assume that ranching activity would also fall within the what is defined in the next page as farm use, but you are right, it raises some ambiguity. I do see Mr. Hendricks here from Legislative Council's office. I know he didn't draft the bill, but you are right, there's an additional term in addition to the term in farming activity, and that particular term is not defined in the bill. Where farming use, which I assume relates back to farming is, unless this committee or somehow on the floor were to explain that farming and ranching activities are both farm use.
Yeah, I think that needs to be fixed. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Because I would note, actually, ranching myself, and the definition that is in subsection 9, mm-hmm. feeding, breeding, managing, selling livestock, so on and so forth, is in fact ranching. So whether it's where you call it farm or ranch or... And, you know, ranchers don't like to be called farmers, and farmers don't like to be called ranchers.
Well, that terminology always baffled me. Having grown up on the west side of the Cascades, we were clearly farmers and always regarded ourselves that way. But people who had operations that were crops on the east side, as we thought something of an affectation, called themselves ranchers.
Well, that's right. Other questions of the panelists, council?
Chair, members of the committee, I could easily get an amendment taking or ranching activity out, if that would make everyone feel better. I can chat with the drafter to be doubly sure and get back to you before the meeting's over with, in case you want to have the
I think that language needs to mesh. I don't think it works.
I mean, normally we don't do conceptual amendments, but we are getting close to the end, and I may even be able to get a two-word amendment up here in an hour or so.
Why don't you pursue that, and then let's also get input from other people about sort of conceptually that whether that was what was intended.
Mr. Chair, just to kind of follow up on Representative McPherson's question, the original bill referred to 215-203, which is has the definition of farm use, and that's where the language came from. It's raising, harvesting, selling crops, or the feeding, breeding, management, and sale or produce of livestock, poultry, fur-bearing animals, or honeybees, or for dairying and the sale of dairy products, or any other agricultural, horticultural use, or animal husbandry, or any combination thereof. So that's where that came from. And then the language in there that was included was land used for the primary purpose of obtaining profit for money in breeding, raising, kenneling, or training of greyhounds for racing. That was one of the things that was taken out. So there was, and the other one was stabling of horses. So that's kind of the chain of reasoning which the Senate went on.
Well, I appreciate that input, but I would say it's prefaced in either sections 9 and 10 as with the phrase as used in this section. So it's creating a definition that applies just here. It may have been borrowed from elsewhere, but it's creating a definition that applies just here. So I would say I think there's an absolute ambiguity there to have farming or ranching activities in the operative section and then have a definition of farm use, not farming or ranching activities.
Although, excuse me, Mr. Chair, the section 2, which has in the 2A, sub 2A, which has the farming and ranching activities language, as well as the farm use definition under print sub 9, are all part of section 2. So the activities listed and described and detailed under farm use would then pertain to ranching activities or the reference earlier in section 2 under sub 2A. If it's referring to as used in this section, would it not mean in this main section, therefore section 2?
Yes, I see that, although I guess the concern would be that somebody who's doing something that they regard as ranching would claim the credit, and if they weren't doing something that was described over here in 9 or excluded in 10, they might say, well, the credit's given to anybody who's in farming or ranching activities, not necessarily constituting farm use. Now, I see that the juxtaposition of them would certainly strong implication that it's intended to be the definition that controls that credit. I just think that we ought to make sure that connection is clear.
We'll take another questions of this panel. If not, thank you, Deborah. And I would like to call up Steve Lanning and Jessica. I can't read your last name.
Stevens.
I was going to guess at that, but somebody put a P and said stump, and so I wasn't going to embarrass myself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We don't support the bill as written, but I'll make some suggestions when I'm finished. As far as previous testimony on the horrendous grass seed crop this year, I can appreciate that. I used to drive a combine when I was in college, and there definitely were some bad years. The one thing, though, that this doesn't just apply to bad crops and marginal farms. This tax credit, as it's written, also applies to those that are doing very well. It's just a vague giveaway that doesn't have any kind of criteria on who gets it. You're involved in farm use, you get it. Whether your crop's done fine or not. The other misunderstanding that's, I think it's now going to certainly come clear now, is on the Senate side. I think the supporters honestly misspoke on the Senate floor. This bill was touted as a bill that would not hold wages down for minimum wage workers, that it applied to all farm workers and all farms, whether they paid $10 an hour or paid minimum wage. That's what was talked about on the Senate floor. That was what was talked about afterwards in the press from quotes from the sponsor, and as I think we're starting to sort out now, it doesn't. This just applies to folks that are making minimum wage, and we think that it would, because the credit applies only there, that it would tend to hold minimum wage workers at that lower level, because there would not be an economic incentive for farmers to pay them $7.50, $7.60, $7.80 an hour if you get the credit when they get minimum wage. We think that it would make more sense to have a tax credit that's based on individual need or hardship, and we certainly do know about market pressures and weather and things like that when it comes to farm use. But giving it to large growers and large corporations when their crop's not in jeopardy, when their bottom line's doing just fine, doesn't make sense to us. And let me just suggest, we were trying to figure out a way that we could, you know, rather than just oppose the bill, we could come up with something that would be positive. We would suggest that you take the same amount of money that's set aside for this tax credit and you give it to the Department of Agriculture to distribute it to those that need it most, come up with some kind of criteria. So you're not giving it to those annually that are doing just fine, but really are helping marginal farmers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jessica.
Chair Boquist and members of the committee, my name is Jessica Stevens. I'm with SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union. And while we don't have many or have any members that would be impacted directly by this bill, we do support the minimum wage as a core principle of the labor movement. And we just wanted to emphasize that voters approved the state minimum wage that included a cost of living that included cost of living adjustments to account for inflation. If businesses that employ low-wage workers are struggling, then it is certainly fair to discuss how and whether or not to subsidize those employers. But this proposal dodges this discussion since it will create an equal tax loophole for extremely profitable businesses as well as those struggling businesses. I would like to also just further emphasize we think that there is that this discussion of what portion will be actually eligible for the tax credit was glazed over and not appropriately discussed on the Senate floor. We hope that there will be time made for that on the House floor. It was clear that Mr. Warner explained that there is no incentive for employers to pay above minimum wage if, in fact, they won't be eligible for the tax credit, which will extremely hamper any increase in wages for those workers. The backers of this bill testified that legislation is intended to help save jobs and protect farmers from foreign competition, but this bill will not live up to those expectations. Last year, Oregon faced a shortage of farm workers. Limiting the tax credit to only those who pay the minimum wage punishes those who need to pay a little more to attract enough workers and creates an incentive to lower those wages. For over a decade now, Oregon has continued to add loophole after loophole to our tax code. We have seen these policy decisions paid for with money that could have gone to services for seniors and our children. The last thing Oregon needs is to add to the problem with one more loophole. Thank you.
Questions of panel? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Scott Ashcom, John McCulley, and Don. Well, look, I'll bring a lawyer too, huh?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Scott Ashcom with the Oregon Agricultural Alliance. I wanted to passed out written testimony to you. The written testimony is two pages that I penned. On page 2, you will find the conclusion of the Oregon Department of Agriculture's study on the effect of the minimum wage and COLA on agriculture based on a study done by ODA in 2004. That study is attached to your written testimony. The conclusion, which is on page 2 of my written testimony, indicates that in the state of Washington and in the state of Oregon, which are the two states that have the automatic COLA escalator, in the year 2004, agricultural employment in those two states was reduced from 48,000 to 41,000 farm workers employed. My estimate is that Oregon's share of the lost jobs here in Oregon is about 2,500 jobs that were lost because of the effect of the minimum wage increase here in the state of Oregon. What this bill about is about jobs. It's about stopping the loss of jobs in Oregon, stopping jobs from fleeing across the border to states that have lower minimum wage. That's what the bill is intended to do, is to stop the loss of those jobs, to be able to create a situation where farmers can continue to employ farm workers at entry-level positions so that they can keep jobs in Oregon, 2,500 jobs in the year 2004. I'll explain to you kind of how the jobs themselves flee to Oregon and may flee to California. For example, in Malheur County, Oregon, which is right on the Idaho border, you have a number of onion producers, you have a number of sugar beet producers, you have a number of potato producers. The way that production of these commodities goes on is that the crops are harvested in the field by farm workers. Then they're trucked from the field to a shed where, say, the onions are graded, they're washed, they're sorted, and they're packed into boxes, and then those boxes are shipped off to a wholesale grocery outlet. If the farmer, I should add that the crops are usually harvested by the same workers that pack them in the sheds and sort them and grade them and wash them in sheds. If an Oregon farmer who has to pay $7.25 just simply moves his packing shed to Nissa from Malheur County, a mile or two drive away, he can pay $5.15 an hour to the workers instead of the $7.25. That he pays in Oregon. So the jobs themselves are leaving the state of Oregon because of the impact of the minimum wage. And it's not the impact of the minimum wage being increased that's creating the job loss in the state of Oregon. It's the disparity between the minimum wages in the various states. For example, Washington just adjusted to $7.35 an hour. Oregon has $7.25 an hour. California has a minimum wage of $6.75 an hour. But Idaho has a minimum wage of $5.15 an hour. So that's a tremendous incentive to actually export a farm job and a farm worker's job and a farm worker's income to the state of Idaho. And this incentive will continue to grow as the Oregon minimum wage escalates. And then you will begin to see the exportation of jobs across the border of California in Klamath County. For example, potato producers and tree fruit growers and fruit growers in Jackson and Josephine County. You'll start to see those jobs migrating to California. So what this is about is creating an incentive for farmers to keep the jobs that they now have in place here in Oregon. The way to do that is to eliminate their incentive to ship those jobs to other states. So we're saying that agriculture is coming to you for help. The Senate heard our plea, and they answered us with a 25-4 vote in support of it. It keeps jobs in Oregon. It prevents farm workers from having to migrate to another state where they're paid almost $3 less an hour in wage. So we're asking for your help, and we ask for your support and vote yes on Senate Bill 1083. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Don.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. First, I'd also like to thank Representative Schaffler for advancing this concept, actually last session already. Didn't get any traction last session. This session, he reintroduced the bill along with the support of Representative Krupp. So I'd like to thank him for throwing his support behind this as well this session. This bill is about jobs and the economy. First, I would like to say that the bill does not reduce wages of anyone, whether it's minimum wage or above minimum wage. The bill does not reduce the wages of anyone. So forget that idea. I mean, I hear talk about minimum wage and what it does to minimum wage and so on. It doesn't do anything to the employees. The employees are paid the maximum amount that can be paid for the kind of work that they're doing and what the market will bear. I guess what I'd also like to say at that point is agriculture operates on a per unit basis. We put all our expenses into the product in the preparation of the ground and the growing it, the seed, the fertilizer, everything that's needed to get it up there. And then it comes to the harvest time, and we finally find out what we're going to get for it. And so then we have to harvest it. Well, there's only a certain amount of money left between what you've paid to plant the crop and get it ready to harvest and what you're going to get for it. And that's what limits the amount of labor that you can pay. A couple years ago, I had a pretty good heavy prune crop on my orchard, got a 20-acre prune orchard, ripe prune is on the ground. And so I was going to hand pick them. We had been doing a lot of machine picking, but they're all on the ground. You can't pick them up with a machine on the ground. And so you hire harvesters to do that. I got a hold of a farm labor contractor, brought him out. I had everything all set up, and they went to work. And after 4 hours, I checked how much had they picked, what was the value to me, and what was going to be my cost for harvesting that. The harvest cost exceeded the value of what I was going to get for my prunes. They all went to waste. We dismissed the crew after 4 hours. That was the end of that. Why do you pay more than what you're even going to get back? But that's what you have to do, and that's what happens in agriculture. So it really doesn't make any difference what the crop is. Doesn't make any difference what the size of the operator is. You have to operate within that unit, and you have to make money. And if you can't make money on that crop, you're going to switch to another crop. So having said that, I'd like to go back to the jobs and the economy issue. This is about jobs because it enables agriculture to employ farm workers by mitigating the effects of the indexing of the minimum wage. That's what we have to do. We can't continue to pay more and more and more and more. It just doesn't work. You're going to run not only the hand-harvested crops out of production, but you're going to run the whole agricultural community out of production. It's about jobs because employed farm workers use fewer state services. So there's a big advantage in employing to the state, and that's employing farm workers. It's about jobs because although agriculture producers may not make much of a profit, everyone who provides material, supplies, processing, transporting, and marketing will have a job. So there's a total ripple effect to the agricultural economy. It's about the agricultural economy because if we lose the hand labor crops, then the remaining mechanized crops will be overproduced. If I can't produce the hand labor crops and make a profit, I'm going to go to the mechanized ones. Well, that's what everybody else is doing. And then pretty soon you're going to tank the whole agricultural economy. And it's about the Oregon economy because agriculture is still one of the largest single sectors of Oregon's economy. So it's key all the way through. I would like to, Mr. Chairman, invite Mr. Brunacek at the end of Mr. McCullough's testimony to make some comments regarding interpretation of the bill, as we heard from the Revenue Office. With that, I guess I would again employ you to support this bill. We would not like any amendments to the bill. The bill needs to move. It needs to move quickly. We're getting out of here soon, aren't we? And so we would very much encourage you to send this out today, even with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
John. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John McCulley. I'm here representing the tree fruit industry, and these are the apple, pear, cherry growers in the mid-Columbia, Jackson County, and Umatilla County. I'm not going to add too much more to what has already been said because the two previous witnesses have clearly explained the need for the bill. I'm just here to voice the support of the fruit industry, who does face those competitive pressures from not only other states in the United States who have lower minimum wages, but other countries, as you heard Representative Krupp talking about the Chilean pears. We believe that this bill will be an incentive to retain the workforce that works in hand-harvested, hand-pruning of the fruit trees. This is a very labor-intensive product, and probably one that doesn't lend itself to mechanical harvest like other crops might. So we anticipate that hand harvest of fruit will continue for a long time. And if that doesn't happen, then those orchards will be taken out and we'll have to go to some other use, and we would not like to see that. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we urge your adoption of Senate Bill 1083.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I understand from the presentation that was made by Legislative Revenue that this would only apply to increases that are actually occurring to the labor force that's involved. So I think the way I mentally think about it is we've got people who are earning just minimum wage. And then we've got people who are earning much more than that. For example, I grew up on a farm in Linn County where we had a longtime career farmhand who was with the family for many years, raised his family on the place, and he earned several times minimum wage because he was worth it, and minimum wage was never part of the consideration. And obviously this wouldn't have any impact on a worker like that. The concern has been raised about those people who are earning just a little bit more than minimum wage and whether it will be a disincentive for the grower to raise the income just a little above minimum wage, because right at that point it may be maybe that losing the tax credit could be a disincentive. So the question is, how many people earn just a little bit more than minimum wage?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Bernasek, General Counsel at the Oregon Farm Bureau, Representative McPherson, to get at your question, I guess I'd like to address a bigger issue, which is I don't believe, and I'd like to march you through the exact language of the bill, I don't believe that the interpretation that this only applies to minimum wage workers or those slightly above is correct. And here's why. If you look at the bill under Section 2, it talks about who the taxpayers are that this will apply to, and then who the employees of those taxpayers are that the credit will apply to. On line 10, subsection C says, and I'll just read it to you, the employees described in paragraph B of the subsection are employed at an hourly rate that equals or exceeds the hourly minimum wage as provided by law. It does not say it only applies to those equals minimum wage, and it does not apply to those who equals the minimum wage or exceeds it by just a little bit. It exceeds the minimum wage. So that's the first step. Then we ask ourselves, okay, so if this applies to employees whose wages equal or exceed the hourly minimum wage, what is the amount of the credit? So you go to subsection 2, sub 2, it talks about for the first year who it applies to. It basically says it's going to be it's only half of the wages paid during the tax year that are attributable to increases in the minimum wage required by law. Now, the operative language there is increases in the minimum wage required by law. If you look at the law we're talking about, is ORS 653.025. And I don't have that in front of me here, but if you look at that section, it talks about, there's a whole history of minimum wage increases up to 690 was the last statutorily provided rate of 690. And then it says, and every year thereafter, something effective, there's an inflationary index. So what we're talking about here is the tax credit is that rate that the increases, the annual increases, not the increase, not the one increase for 1 year, the increases in the minimum wage attributable, the increase in the wage attributable to increases in the minimum wage. So for example, if you, again, just marching through the statute again, back up and go through this again, who it applies to are every employee who's being paid a rate that equals or exceeds the minimum wage, then how much is it? Well, for this first year, it's for tax year 2006-2007, it'll be 50% of the wages. They're attributable to increases in the minimum wage required by law. Well, what increases are those? Well, first we went to 690. Then we had an increase the first year. I believe it was 705, I think. Mm-hmm. Then the next increase was 725. And then as Mr. Warner describes it, it may go up to 740, whatever that is. We can't define it any clearer than increases because we don't know what that inflationary index is. But I think it's very clear under the language here, and as you know, under PGE Boley, the way courts interpret this is plain meaning first, then you go to context and legislative history. I think it's very clear as you march through this language who this applies to. Again, everybody whose rate equals or exceeds the minimum wage. And the amount is that rate due to the increases, not the increase from 06-07, but increases that are required by law. So I think that's how we have to march through this statute. I think that's how a court is going to look at this. And that's why it is correct to say that this will apply to anybody whose rates, who are paid a wage above the minimum wage, but it's only for that segment that's attributable. For example, if it were in effect right now, from 690 to $7.25. That's 35 cents. So if this were in effect right now, that's what that
half rate of that, is. Half of that for the first year.
And half of that for the first year. And then it goes on to sub B, 2 sub B, which talks about the rest of the remaining 3 years, I guess, of the tax credit.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, remember this has a four-year sunset on it.
President Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if Don's paying his prune picker $10 an hour and the cost of living goes up 25 cents, he's still paying the guy $10 an hour, he gets a 20 or whatever percentage of that, he gets a tax credit, even though the farm worker actually doesn't see any increase.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, that is correct. I mean, if that were to happen. Now, let me get, again, marching through the analysis, but then let me give you the story of what does happen on the farm due to the increases. Again, the employee's being paid $10 an hour. So they meet the initial threshold, which is they're paid a rate that equals or exceeds the minimum wage. So that employee is somebody who's covered. Then what is it? The wage that's paid that are attributable to the increases in the minimum wage. Now, you said it was $7.25, so it went up whatever it was. It's going to be that segment. Now, what happens, though, in reality on the farm, when you have... That's the short answer to your question. But what happens on the farm when you have these automatic increases is you have employees coming back year after year after year to work on your farm. They are given bumps. I mean, you have to attract, keep these valuable workers there. And so what happens is when you have a bump at the lower end, your first year employee shows up and they're paid $7.40 or whatever it is, then the individuals working the year before that maybe you've bumped them up to $7.40, they're saying, wait a minute, I'm getting paid exactly what the guy who's brand new here is. How does that affect me? So you end up bumping that person up and all the way up the line. That's generally how, in practicality, it works on the farm. So it would be very likely that there would be an increase for those people. Does it happen every single time? No, but that's how you keep people coming to the farm.
President McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking through the room to see if Mr. Werner was still here. Is anybody here from Legislative Revenue? Because what I need to know is he gave us some, orally gave us some revenue impacts that I think were based on a different interpretation of the bill than what I'm just hearing now. That is, it's based on only applying to the extent that people's minimum wage was lifting their pay level. And that was the figure of $1.3 million for the current biennium and $5.3 million for the following biennium. But the interpretation I'm hearing now is one that would take essentially the entire payroll. I mean, go back to the family farm I grew up on. We had a long-time career worker was with the family since 1961 until he went sort of still with the family, in fact. But he got paid several times minimum wage. He was paid a salary. But... it sounds like the minimum wage amount, under your interpretation, would apply to him, somebody who is earning, as I say, several times minimum wage, and the family farm would have been entitled to a credit for that amount. Am I hearing that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, again, it's an hourly rate, so I don't know, maybe you'd have to back out the salary to the hourly rate, but the plain language is hourly rate. But I think that's right. And again, I think if you look at kind of farm economics, as you do see, and I don't think it's just farm economics, it's economics in a lot of businesses, when you have increased employment rates, there often is a ripple effect up. And so the whole idea behind the bill was to keep farmers, keep the jobs and the employment base here. We are unique in that not many other states and certainly not other countries have a automatically increasing cost stream. And so how do we keep ourselves competitive to keep those jobs here and that farm contribution to the economy here? It's essentially you're freezing the effect of the increases at 690. Obviously, the workers are made whole. They're being paid the rate they need, but we're keeping our farmers at a position where we can compete with the Idahos at 575 or whatever they are and try and compete with other countries.
Scott, you have an answer?
Mr. Chairman, if I can try to answer Senator McPherson's question. I'm not
I'm not as deep an individual, and I don't count probably as well as Tim does. I'm just kind of an ordinary folk. But what I heard, we had a public hearing on House Bill 2597, which is the bill which Senate Bill 1083 is really based on. And that bill received a revenue analysis when it was in the House. And the Revenue Department of the House, Revenue Section of the House, based the number of employees that would be eligible for the credit. They set that number at approximately 12,500 employees. So the Department of Revenue already has a methodology in place where they can estimate how many farm employees would make a farm employer eligible for the tax credit because they increased the wage of that employee due to an increase in the minimum wage, 12,500 employees, and that calculated out to, and this is the language that's in the bill here, Senate Bill 1083, a 17.5 cent tax credit. I view it as a tax offset. A 17.5 cent per hour tax credit in tax year 2006 at 50% of the increase. And then when the bill fully phases in tax year 2007, it's a 35 cent per hour tax credit. The tax credit is based on the increase in wage. It's really not based on an employee in any way. It's based on the increase in wage due to the automatic COLA adjustment. And that comes to 17.5 cents an hour in aught 6 and goes up to 35 cents an hour in aught 7.
Well, plus.
I'm hearing things that I don't see in the bill, and what I thought I heard from Paul Warner is that it would be the new base, and I thought he was saying, telling us that we're now at 7.25 an hour, and that would be the base, and that whatever increase occurred in 06, you know, if it was an increase of 20 cents, we don't know what it'll be. I think he said, in fact, 740 is what they project. So that's a 15 cent increase. So that what would happen is that 15 cent per hour increase between 05 and 06 would be the base for the 50% credit in 06. So in other words, it'd be half of 15 cents. It'd be 7.5 cents per hour times the payroll of people who are getting that new minimum wage. Now what I'm hearing offered up as another interpretation is it's not just the people who are getting minimum wage, it's everybody who's employed on the farm payroll. Even my example from our family farm of the guy who's earning, you know, three times the minimum wage, it would be applied on an hourly rate basis to his hours as well. I mean, those are two rather different interpretations, and I think you need to get to the bottom of them. I would be looking to focus on the direct impacts of the minimum wage. I mean, what we have here is a social policy that the citizens of Oregon decided that they want to have all minimum wage workers get a COLA adjustment. And I'm a strong supporter of that policy, that broad policy. But as applied to agriculture, it has devastating impacts because you're competing in a global marketplace where the cost of labor gets driven down. So what we're doing then is we're saying that the cost of supporting that, making that social policy decision and applying it to agriculture as well as everything else, we, the people of Oregon, are going to undertake that cost rather than applying it to farmers. But I'd say I can make that leap if we're talking about the increment in the minimum wage. We're not applying it to the complete farm payroll, which is, and I agree with Mr. Vanasek that the or exceeds language creates some ambiguity. I don't think it's clear. I think it's ambiguous, but it suggests that it's for people who are paid higher, a higher amount. And actually, in a sidebar, even before that comment was made, Mr. Taylor indicated to me that some concern had already been expressed about the or exceeds language, that it created an ambiguity, and that we ought to be, in the amendments to the bill, we ought to be removing that phrase so that it's clear that it's the increments in the minimum wage. Any reactions?
Council? Mr. Chairman, as committee, as often happens this time of year, we have quick discussions of the phone. I've had a quick discussion with Dexter Johnson and then Paul Warner about the bill, and we actually have
three different sets of amendments coming, and I could probably tell you what they are. I will tell you what they are, and they should be here probably within an hour. I have a feeling we're still going to be here. On line 11 will be an amendment. We'll take all the, out the word "or exceeds." That's on page 1. On 14, there will be an amendment that could be after 2, put 2 annual increases. And to clarify the issue, if the committee decides to go that way, that, for example, if it goes from 740 to 750, that's 10 cents per employee for that year. And if it goes from 750 to 760, it will be 10 cents for the following year. It wouldn't be 20 cents. Now, these are policy issues, but they will be before you for your decision to make. And then the other one is taking out all ranching activity. That appears to be redundant, and at best will cause some confusion. So there will hopefully be three sets of amendments, and they'll be here probably within an hour.
No, sir. It was a comment on something that's been addressed. Thank you.
Before I go, let me ask a question to the panel first.
Back downstairs.
The farm use or ranching definition, I mean, is there clarity on that?
Mr. Chairman, the definition of farm use includes ranching.
Right.
Because it includes livestock.
Right.
So I don't see that as a problem. My closing comment, if I might, Mr. Chair, as Mr. Bernasek described the bill, that is exactly what we have to do if agriculture is to remain whole. If agriculture is to remain in this state, we have to do that. There's no other way. There is no other way. It holds all workers harmless. They will continue to be paid the highest possible wage, minimum wage and above, as the market bears. We always pay our workers as much as we can, and we have to in order to keep them. We are going to become uncompetitive. We won't be able to compete with other states if we don't do this. So I implore you not to make the changes that are being suggested. That'll devastate the bill, and ultimately agriculture is going to go down the tube in this state.
Mr. Chair, if I might
go ahead.
One thing that, there's a sunset on this bill of 4 years, and it just seems to me that, Don's comments, when we were putting this and talking to, putting the ideas together to do this bill, it was exactly what we've talked about today to do, and it's very hard to mirror the language to hit that automatic index because you don't know what that index figure is. And so the Legislative Council's done the best they can here, and I think they frankly got it right. But I would suggest too that it's very difficult, and Mr. Warner could address this better than I, to get an exact fiscal impact of what this is going to do over the years, because we don't know what the index increase is going to be. But I would just suggest that let's test run this. It's got a 4-year sunset on it. Let's see what it does. Let's see if there are people that don't deserve this, if we can delineate who they are. I think, given the facts of how agriculture operates, excuse me, that increases do affect the entire operation because of the bump-up effect. But I may be wrong. But what we will see that in the data. We'll have hard data if we test run this and try this out, and agriculture desperately needs it. So I would urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
You have a follow-up question,
Representative McPherson? I don't want to belabor, I think we've heard
we're going to come back to
these
this,
issues,
so.
but I want to go back to a question I asked earlier, because I really do think that to be viable, the bill needs to focus on the people who are at minimum wage and who are getting these law-driven increases. So going back to that question, how many workers are there who are paid just a little more than minimum wage? Because is that...
Well, Mr. Chairman, the Revenue Department estimated that 12,500 Oregon workers would qualify their employers because of an increase in the minimum wage. And remember that the bill is written to state that the wage has to be increased as a result of the increase in the minimum wage that's statutorily prescribed by the initiative petition. So they're estimating 12,500. So I would say that's the figure you're looking for, 12,500 or thereabouts.
Except that, Mr. Chairman, working on a piece rate, that depends on the worker. It depends on whether they can even make minimum wage. If they can't make minimum wage, we either have to fire them or subsidize them. So those wouldn't qualify. then you have those working, still working on the piece rate. They may make 726. They would qualify. The other guy, he works a little faster. He makes 740. He wouldn't qualify. And it's just become a nightmare trying to keep track of who qualifies and who doesn't qualify. And then when it gets to the Department of Revenue, how are they going to know? It's nigh impossible.
And Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, just a comment on your suggestion. If we do just tie this to minimum wage or those slightly above, I think the unions, if we did that, I think the unions are absolutely correct that that is a terrible policy comment to create an incentive to keep workers that are highly skilled, highly valued at that lower rate simply because employers will lose their tax credit and have to face the entire effects of the increased minimum wage simply because they want to reward that worker for being a productive and viable part of the operation. That's why one of the earlier drafts of our bill came back that did just apply, the language is very clear, did just apply to minimum wage workers, and we identified very early that that is not what we want to do is, say, in agriculture, to provide that perverse incentive to employers to keep those wages artificially deflated simply to take advantage of this credit. So I would just suggest to you that we need to think about the policy implications of that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I just want to be sure I understand this. So and then essentially any hourly farm worker would be, the farmer would get a credit. If the guy's making $20 an hour, it doesn't matter. They would still get the credit for the increase.
Not just hourly. Salary.
Yeah.
That's correct.
And so that's
the intent.
Okay, that wasn't what I heard Mr. Warner say when he talked about the numbers of people. So.
And we disagree, Mr. Chairman. We disagreed with Mr. Warner.
Okay. And thank you for clarifying that the earlier piece had the minimum wage or it would have affected.
Right.
That was that apparently was some of the confusion
I
was hearing.
I think so.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I'm
pretty much
for it. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, gentlemen. My gracious, I left the room and look what happened.
Just imagine if you'd been here.
I think what we're going to do for now is ask Mr. Warner to get together with you folks and check to make sure that we have the proper paper estimate on the revenue, mm-hmm. on the revenue forecast.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. There's you and I and who else?
And from our side, and then
Andy there.
Again, Gordon.
Okay.
Take a recess.
No, I'll let him go ahead.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 1083 and ask those people to get together.
We're still waiting for amendments for that.
Why don't you run this because they go down conference committee again?
Okay. We're going to move beyond 3505 because we're still pending some amendments. They'll be here in a few minutes, and we're going to open a public hearing on SJR 24. And Cletus, will you bring us up to speed?
Chair of Committee, SJR 24, honor service and accomplishments of former Governor Victor Giatia and Barbara Roberts. Directs Port of Portland to name a terminal after the Portland International Airport after Victor Giatia. Resolves that Oregon Department of Human Services Building headquartered for department be renamed the Barbara Roberts Human Services Building. Former Governor Victor Giatia was the first governor of Arab descent to be elected anywhere in the United States. He won two gubernatorial elections by decisive margins and is credited with expanding international trade opportunities for the state of Oregon and establishing the first statewide food bank. Former Governor Barbara Roberts was the first woman to serve as a majority leader of the House of Representatives and the first woman to be elected governor of Oregon. She also served as Secretary of State. Roberts is credited with enacting election reform legislation and advancing the cause of public education, human rights, and children advocacy during her years in public service.
Senator.
Thank you. For the record, Bruce Starr, State Senator from District 15, representing Western Washington County. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support in behalf of Senate Joint Resolution 24. I think that as a state, it's way past time that we recognize and honor former Governor Victor Attia. And there's a number of reasons why I think that's important. And I think it's the fact, really, that Governor Attia was a tremendous leader for the state of Oregon at a very difficult time in Oregon's history. In our last severe recession, in the late 70s, early 80s, Governor Attia led this state through that with incredible grace, poise, and leadership. The resolution itself outlines some of the interesting facts around that. But I think that you look at why Portland International Airport. And I think that it's appropriate because Governor Attia really opened the door of Oregon to the rest of the world. It was under Governor Attia's leadership that we've established trade offices in Asia. It's under Governor Attia's leadership that we developed sister state relationships with cities in Asia. It's because of Governor Attia's leadership in the repeal of the unitary tax that we attracted so much significant foreign investment in Oregon and really laid the foundation from which today Oregon's high-tech economy is based. The area that I represent in Western Washington County, the Silicon Forest, really has its roots in Governor Attia's leadership. And when, prior to the session, there was a group of us that tried to look at an opportunity to honor Governor Attia, didn't take us very long to identify the airport itself as a place that of appropriate recognition. For the committee's information, I have worked with the executive director, Bill Wyatt, of the port and port staff. The commission, they're okay with what is in SGR 24. They assisted us in that. We are going to recognize Governor Attia, provided this committee and the House of Representatives approve this resolution. We're going to honor Governor Attia by naming the international terminal at PDX for him. And I trust that the port and the commission will do that in a way that is appropriate to the governor's service. I want to thank my chief co-sponsor, Senator Metzger, and with his help, really, in bringing this bill, this resolution through the Senate. And I'll turn over the microphone to my colleague, Senator Metzger.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you,
welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. I think Senator Starr told the story well. We initiated this resolution in honor of Governor Attia because of the tremendous work that he has done, his visionary work in the early 80s, realizing where Oregon's economy was going to go, realizing that being a port city on the West Coast and the ties to Asia and the growth in Asia, this was critical. It is fitting and proper that we do this, and certainly the international wing of Portland International Airport, since it is so closely tied to the work he has done, would be very appropriate. And also, in the Senate side, Governor Roberts was also honored for her great work in human services. If you have a moment, the comments made by Senator Winters on both Governor Roberts and Attia, you might want to note those, because having worked in the administrations of both, really saw the value that they brought to the state. So I think this is very, very fitting that these two leaders be recognized. And certainly thank you for bringing this forward, and to Senator Starr on our initial proposal for the airport for Governor Attia. I think it's just a very, very fitting and proper move that we make. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Questions, Representative McPherson? You okay with this?
I'm fine.
Well,
I'm delighted with this.
Mr. Chair, just for one more comment. We have buildings named and places named for politicians, Oregon politicians, kind of all, in lots of places. And I think that it's fitting that we recognize Governor Attia. There isn't that recognition. Some folks have asked, do we want to wait until after he passes on? And I think it's appropriate to have him be recognized while he's still here to enjoy that. So
great. I appreciate that. I appreciate the testimony. And with that, I believe I'm going to open a work session on SJR 24, and I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move SJR 24A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson has moved SJR 24 to the floor with a
adopt
recommendation. Is there discussion? If there is no discussion,
Would you please call the roll and have it reflected that Representative Barker and Representative Krieger are out on House business?
Representative Barker excused. Representative Lopez?
Yes.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
And Chair Krieger excused.
SJR 24, having received the required majority, is passed. And having said that, is there any discussion of putting this on the consent calendar, or would you like to carry it?
I'd be happy to carry it. I guess the question is whether this a ceremonial kind of recognition like this really probably ought to not be just on the consent calendar. Probably ought to have a
speech. Then a carrier is appointed as Representative McPherson.
Okay.
Thank you. With that, we're going to close the work session and public hearing on SJR 24, and we're still waiting on stuff on House Bill 3505, so we're going to open, there's Joe, a public hearing only on SB 1067.
Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1067 comes to you from the Senate Rules Committee. It was sponsored at the request of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. It is the bill that would amend the existing telephonic harassment statute. Under current law, telephonic harassment is a Class B misdemeanor, and it's committed if the actor intentionally harasses or annoys another person by causing the telephone of another to ring when the caller has no communicative purpose, or in circumstances where the caller has been forbidden from calling the person. This measure would add an alternative way of violating the statute, that is, if the caller sends or leaves a text message, voicemail, or any other message, if the caller knows that they have been forbidden from doing so to the phone of another. There are no amendments that have been received, at least by staff.
I have an amendment dash one in my file. Have you seen that?
Representative Boquist, I have not.
Okay. We have three individuals signed up. Gina Skinner, Sybil Hebb, and Jim Marquis. Jim, you're neutral, it says, so I'll let you come over these ladies.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist and members of the committee. My name is Gina Skinner, and I'm a Deputy District Attorney in Washington County. I'm representing the Oregon District Attorney Association. It is our association that drafted this bill. Basically, we consider this to be a house cleaning bill in the sense that it is just keeping up with modern technology. Originally, years ago, when we had telephonic harassment, we didn't have the ability for somebody to text message another individual or to send voicemail directly to a phone without having the normal rotary type phone ring in someone's home, which is how the technology used to work. We get these kind of cases on a regular basis, and the concern is I have been prosecuting domestic violence crimes for over 8 years as a deputy district attorney, and this is often seen in domestic violence offenses and stalking type offenses where a victim has indicated that they do not want to be contacted anymore by that individual and they continue to harass them. I have a case specifically that came to our office in Washington County from September of 2004 where a victim was concerned because a boyfriend became very possessive, so she ended the relationship after a short period of time of dating this fellow, and he continued sending her text messages on her cell phone. She contacted the police, asked the police to ask him to stop contacting him, and when the police looked at her phone, there was 195 text messages that he had sent her. 100 of them was since she had specifically told him to stop text messaging her. This was a case that we were unable to prosecute because there's no law that prevents somebody from doing that. If you just send a text message directly to somebody, the law currently does not cover that, and we had to tell this individual that we're sorry, but we could not prosecute that case. As a result, of that case and a couple of others that have come through our office, we have decided as an organization that we wanted to amend the statute just to cover those areas, and we hope that this committee will agree that that it is a simple, straightforward amendment. We understand that there is a dash one amendment that is dealing specifically with wanting to exempt collection agencies from this provision. We do not want this bill to get bogged down in these kind of amendments because the current law, as drafted, doesn't have anything to do with the tax collection and so, or the collecting of debts. And so the amendment that we're making doesn't change what the law already does. Our understanding is that they don't use text messaging in an effort to collect old debts, and so this is something that really is not addressed this would be further changing what the current law is, which currently says under the law that you have to intentionally harass or annoy another person. And our position is that people that are collecting debts are calling multiple times to collect debts. They're not calling to intentionally harass or annoy the person, which is what the law requires. And so we would ask this committee not to get sidetracked into another amendment. We very much would like to see this bill passed out of this committee as soon as possible.
Thank you. Ma'am?
Thank you, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, and we urge the committee's support for Senate Bill 1067, also without the amendments. As the Law Center, we are providers of civil legal assistance to low-income Oregonians. Many of our clients are unfortunately victims of domestic violence or sexual assault, and so although we're not dealing with the criminal prosecutions, we do see the impact of the harassing behavior on our clients, and we have seen many circumstances in which clients have suffered from harassment delivered via text messaging, surprisingly. Some of the text messages have been as explicit and threatening as, you know, do X or you die. And those are clearly inappropriate messages that deserve to be sanctioned in the same way that a similar message delivered via the telephone is currently sanctioned under the law. And so we appreciate the amendment to the bill and believe that it's not expanding inappropriately the law, but merely updating it to cover inappropriate behavior that's expressed via new technology. And so for that reason, we're supportive of the bill. In terms of the amendments, which we had the chance to see just a bit ago and appreciate that, the concern from my perspective is that we go down a scary road, I think, when we start to exempt whole classes of people from criminal prosecution. To me, it seems as though the criminal law should be designed to address behavior, inappropriate, threatening, harassing behavior. If that behavior is committed, is expressed, then it should be sanctioned, regardless of who is committing the behavior. And so if we exempt debt collectors from any criminal prosecution, regardless of whether they have intentionally chosen to harass a person, then that seems like bad public policy. The concern that I also have is that it leads to sort of the question of what other classes of people are we going to start exempting from prosecution. Clearly, people may feel like they wouldn't want to be contacted excuse me, by their attorneys or by their DHS caseworkers or what have you, and if there are people who are being inappropriate, threatening, harassing, they should be prosecuted regardless of what who they are. Would urge the committee not to to adopt the amendment. To the extent that amendment is considered, then we would urge the committee to please consider a more narrow amendment. As drafted, the amendment basically indicates that a telephone caller does not include any person who is engaged in or collecting a debt. And there are certainly, unfortunately, in domestic relations situations, many circumstances in which an abusive partner or an abusive husband may be calling with the purported purpose of collecting a debt, but really is behaving as part of a larger pattern of the underlying domestic violence. And so for that reason, we'd be concerned about the amendment. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Harkey.
Good time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. I am responsible, I guess, for the Dash 1 amendments. I would agree with both of the previous witnesses to some extent. The first witness said that this statute, 166090, was never intended to apply to debt collectors, and I agree with that. I agree with the second witness to the extent that the amendment as drafted may be too broad. I would like the committee, however, to consider this issue of whether a professional debt collector acting in accordance with his duties as a debt collector, collecting for a commercial creditor in a consumer transaction, whether they should be subject to a criminal action if someone accuses them of intentionally harassing or annoying them. These are very confrontive situations from time to time between debtors and debt collectors. Debtors say a lot of things. There are currently in place, and I gave you a copy of the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act of Oregon under 646-639. Currently, debt collectors are prohibited from calling people if they've been told not to do so. And there's a right of private action under that statute that the debtor can bring to the collection agency for actual damages or $200, whichever is greater, together with punitive damages, attorney fees, etc. Further, third-party debt collectors are regulated by the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, which is administered by the Federal Trade Commission. There are right of private action there, and civil penalties can be brought by the Federal Trade Commission. So for these professional debt collectors, there are civil remedies available to aggrieved parties, and we're growing somewhat concerned about the use of this criminal statute, although there's not been a prosecution in Oregon, but potentially there could be, and we would like to see the committee address that concern.
Great, thank you. Representative McPherson, questions? We're obviously in public hearing only, and if Joe, you would get together with the panel member at some point and look at that amendment, please, just in case we decide to move this.
May I ask a question further into that? The question is both to the committee and to the panel. Would it be would you consider it less risky, as Ms. Hebb pointed out, than exempting, as the current language, anyone collecting a debt or professional debt collectors, but still reaching the goal that Mr. Marquis pointed out, to craft an affirmative defense applicable to professional debt collectors collecting a debt in the course of their duty, as opposed to a whole class exemption? Would that still meet Mr. Marquis' need and still be acceptable to prosecutors? And
if it was phrased as an affirmative defense, and that it was that class of people that was that they were acting in the manners in which they are required to act, that we probably would not be opposed to that. I guess the concern that we have, as Ms. Hebb previously stated, is that if they, as that class, but they're acting outside of how they're supposed to be acting, that we don't want this to protect them when they are, in fact, acting in a manner that is unprofessional.
Got it, counsel?
I do. I've got affirmative defense, professional collector within the scope of their duties, or the three elements, and if I get a little bit of an assent from the committee, I'll go ahead and try to get that drafted.
I like that strategy.
Yeah, and my intent is to get us closer to something we agree in case we do move this bill.
Thank you.
Great. With that, I'm going to close the, thank you for your testimony, close the public hearing on SB 1067 and open a public hearing on 1068.
Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1068A comes to you from the Senate Rules Committee. This is the bill that would require a peace officer to arrest a person without a warrant if that peace officer has probable cause to believe that the person has been charged with an offense, is presently released as to that charge pursuant to a release agreement, and that person has failed to comply with a no-contact condition of the release agreement. The current statute is 133.310, and that statute already requires a peace officer to arrest a person if the officer has PC that a person has violated the no-contact provision of the release agreement, but it only applies under current law to domestic violence charges. What this bill would change is that it would broaden the scope to any underlying charge where there is a release agreement, that is, an agreement in writing, and where there is a no-contact provision as part of that agreement. And it would make it... I was going to say what class of a misdemeanor or felony it would make it, but it wouldn't. It is just a direction to arrest.
That's correct. Okay.
Question of staff before we proceed? Ladies?
Thank you, Chair Boquist. Gina Skinner again from the Oregon District Attorney's Association. This was another one of the bills that we felt very strongly about. This has become an issue that the original bill actually addressed the last comment that Mr. O'Leary was going to mention. The original bill did, in fact, change the punishment to make this a Class A misdemeanor, but, in fact, in front of the Senate Rules Committee, the parties came to this with the OCDLA as some sort of a compromise that it addressed one of the concerns of the District Attorney Association has. There's basically two reasons that we feel that this bill is very important. Primarily, right now, people are getting arrested, and you hear about this in the paper all the time for crimes, and the jails are full, and so people are getting released. When they are getting released, all defendants are given a release agreement that says that when they get released from jail, they have to comply with a number of conditions, one of which is to come back to court when they have their court appearance. Another one is if there is a victim of the crime, that they are not allowed to contact that person while the case is pending. This is a time that is very dangerous for victims. Victims are often contacted by suspects in an effort to try to influence their testimony, to scare them from going forward with the charges, from trying to intimidate them in some manner. And so the idea is to give the victim some kind of protection by saying that there's this piece of paper that says that the suspect cannot contact them. The concern that we have, and this goes into our second reason for why this bill is very important, is that it is very difficult to enforce these orders. It's nice to on paper, but the enforcement has become almost impossible. The current law requires, it's a mandatory arrest for a police officer to go out on the scene, and if they know that there's a release agreement and the underlying charges are domestic violence, but not all domestic violence, only domestic violence as defined under ORS 135-230, which is actually very narrow. It only applies to the specific crimes of assault, attempted assault, basically menacing or sex abuse. Those are the only crimes it applies to. Other than those crimes, there's actually no authority under the law for the police officer to arrest, because currently the punishment for violating a release agreement is contempt of court, which is a quasi-civil criminal penalty and is not a crime under Oregon law, and so the police officers don't have authority to arrest. And so they go out to the scene and they find either A, that the person has been charged with some other crime than this one, or B, more likely, they're not sure what the crime is. They just know that there's a release agreement with a no-contact provision, but they don't have access to the specific information about exactly what the crime is. And so their concern is without some kind of statutory provision that gives them the authority to arrest, they're opting to not arrest. And so then the victims don't have any protection at all from the suspects because the police officers don't want to do something that is against the law. And so the compromise that we all agreed to, that the minimum is that we wanted to at least give our position is that we'd like to give a blanket authority to the police that when they know there's a release agreement, the no contact provision with a specific victim. They have probable cause that they have in fact contacted that victim, that in fact the police officer then is directed to arrest that person, and then that would be safe for the victim at any time when the police officer was enforcing it, so they didn't have to wait until, if this happened on a weekend, they didn't have to wait until the next week to go in front of a judge and do paperwork. We want to be able to deal with it right then and there. So we feel that this would be helpful to all the parties. And this is information that the defendants are given when they're released. They have a piece of paper. It spells out that they're not to have contact. The defendants are required to sign it prior to them being released, and they have a copy of it that they leave the jail with that has that information. So they will be on notice that they are not to contact this person. And currently, most of the release agreements I've seen all say specifically that they will be arrested. It's just that the police don't have that last piece that gives them the authority to do it regardless of the underlying crime.
Great. Thank you. Sybil?
Thanks. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Sybil Head for the Oregon Law Center, in support of this bill as well. And I'll keep my comments very brief. I agree with everything that Ms. Skinner mentioned. I also think just specifically victims of sexual assault are given special protection by this bill that they should be entitled to and don't currently have. Right now, victims of domestic violence under the law qualify for protection orders, civil protection orders that can order an abuser, a perpetrator, to stay away from the victim. And those orders, that order is enforceable by mandatory arrest upon a violation. Victims of stalking are also able to be eligible for a stalking protection order that has similar sanctions. Victims of sexual assault don't have any civil protection order available to them unless they are victims within a stalking or a domestic violence relationship. So, for example, a victim of sexual assault where there's no underlying relationship doesn't have a civil protection order available to him or her. The sanctions or the provisions of the of the release order are the only provisions that provide that person with protection during the pendency of the criminal trial, and so we think this bill provides much needed additional protection to victims of sexual assault in the circumstances. So thank you.
Great, thank you very much. Questions, Frederick, Chris?
I ask
counsel.
You both spoke of no contact with victims, which I think is how most practitioners think of it. My read of the bill, though, suggests that it's not that the no contact order pursuant to the security agreement wouldn't just be limited to victims, but could also be witnesses in the criminal case. Is that accurate?
That is correct. This bill is drafted so that it would apply to whomever the release officer felt was appropriate to add to the release agreement. So there can be cases where there might be other people that they're specifically ordered not to have contact with, whether they were maybe gang affiliates or a witness that was a material witness that was concerned for their safety. There may be other people that, this is only while the criminal case is pending. As soon as the criminal case is over, there's release agreement goes away. It doesn't continue on into infinity. So it's just for the purpose of keeping the people safe that potentially could testify against this person at the criminal trial from being unduly influenced or threatened by the suspect. So those would all be specifically listed out on the release agreement by the release officer or the jail deputy as they're being released. Again, the defendant would get a copy of that, and it would specifically spell out all the individuals. Thank you for pointing that out.
Other questions? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1068. And now I'm looking for a staff member for either 1018 or Cletus or Bill Taylor. Just stand at ease for a minute waiting for a staff member. Just waiting for a minute.
I don't know what's going to do. I forgot.
What's that?
What are you looking for?
is a tech committee number. Every bill you get.
Yeah.
Let's get rid of David's 660. Let's do it, and then we'll break and be
right.
And then we'll go back to the top. We're going to open a public hearing on SB 660. Cletus?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 660A requires county board or local boundary commission to approve petition for formation of special district if petition meets specific legal requirements. The purpose of SB 660A is to delineate the extent of a county board or boundary commission's discretion in approving or rejecting petitions for formation of special district. Current statute enumerates specific criteria for counties to consider in reviewing petitions for the formation of a special district. The amendment to the measure makes technical changes to the language of the bill to clarify that one, the county boards and commissions are the decision makers with respect to whether statutory criteria have been satisfied, and two, the county boards and boundary commissions may not base decisions to reject, modify, or approve a petition based on factors not enumerated in current statute.
Thank you. And questions of staff? Amanda Rich. Right.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here today representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you about this priority bill for special districts this afternoon. 660, I can't do any better than your administrator did this afternoon in explaining it. It is simply a clarification bill that clears up an ambiguity in the district formation statute. Right now, there's a little tiny word, if, that's in part of the statute that has, been used to allow some denial of or rejection of formation petitions based on criteria that are outside of the criteria laid out in statute. And that's really not been the understanding of the statute by any parties, frankly. And so what you see before you today, Senate Bill 660A, is an agreement between counties and special districts. We've worked out pretty much every word that you see in that bill, and it passed the Senate on a 27-1 vote, and I would just really appreciate your support of the bill today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. I've provided you with a huge packet of material, but I've decided to give you the kind of McNuggets version this afternoon since we're having, it's late in the afternoon and late in the session, but I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions of Amanda? Representative McPherson, you have that look.
Nope.
Okay, Laura?
No,
thank you, sir. Thank you, Amanda. We appreciate your testimony, and we'll get back with you on this one. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 660, and I'm going to go back to the top of the agenda and open a public hearing only on House Bill 3505. Cletus.
Mr. Chair and committee, we have before you a couple of things. That currently, we're dealing with the Dash 3 amendments for 3505.
Okay.
And also, you have in your possession an opinion from the Department of Justice. HB 3505 provides that public body may condemn property only if the primary purpose for taking the property is to allow the property owner to be owned, maintained, occupied, and used by the public for public purposes. Specifies that conveyance of condemned property to private party is not public purpose. Exempts condemnation of certain properties and declares an emergency effective upon passage. This measure seeks to protect property owners from abuse of eminent domain by a condemner, and a condemner being a state, any city, county, school district, municipality, or public or corporation, political subdivision, or instrumentally or any agency thereof as a private corporation that has the power to exercise the right of eminent domain, be known as the condemner.
Questions of staff?
My question is, I'm just trying to get oriented here on what version we're looking at. We have the bill as introduced, and then there was a reference to, I thought you said a dash 3 amendment.
We now have a dash 3, which just passed out. Should be among your documents. And actually, dash 3 adds a reference to Oregon statute 367.818.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I did have it here.
As a part of it. And you earlier had a dash 1. And dash 1 and dash 2 are to be ignored. Dash 3 is the amendment that we're going to be dealing with the bill.
Okay. Is that Senator Starr, Senator Brzezinski? Here we are back again. Same issue.
Yes.
Different bill number.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Senator Bruce Starr. I represent Senate District 15 in Western Washington County. Appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3505. As you will recall, we had a hearing on a constitutional provision earlier this month, but we've taken a different tact, and this is the tact that we've taken, really based on some of the comments that were raised in the hearing on what was then a public hearing on SGR 10. This is the bill that deals with eminent domain and basically condemning private property and transferring it to another private property owner for economic development purposes. We believe that this is an important public policy issue, one that the state needs to address in light of the recent Supreme Court case. And I think that we've struck a compromise in the language in this bill. As you look at the bill and the dash 3 amendments, I have to give credit to Mr. Honeycutt for working with the various interested parties here to try to craft a bill that doesn't unnecessarily create the unintended consequences that we talked about in our last hearing. The exemptions really that you see here are ones that have been raised by local governments or by the Department of Transportation. The ORS that are in lines 19 and 20 and then in line 5 of the amendment deal with the Department of Transportation specifically. You see the language as it relates to urban renewal and the blighted area section of the bill, sub 2A. I think that as you look at the opportunity to deal with this issue in a statutory fashion, I guess the opportunity to be a little less or a little more specific in creating dealing with unintended consequences, I think is the much greater ability to deal with those in a statutory bill. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I think it's important that we move this bill forward, as we know that the hour, I pray, is becoming late in the legislative session. I got my both fingers crossed, and that is true. I'd ask that the dash 3 amendment be adopted into the bill and that you move the bill forward. I appreciate my colleague, Senator Brzezinski, who is also here to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, committee members, and staff. I also am here in support of what is now House Bill 3505. As Senator Starr said, this is something that basically came about through the discussion that we had previously before this committee, and the concern about maybe rushing too quickly to try to do something through the through a constitutional fix, and instead of having a statutory fix. And I also want to give credit to Mr. Honeycutt for his work with the agencies and the various parties to make certain that we put something together that really is going to fit Oregon. I've just had an opportunity to review the dash 3s, but based on my review, it appears the suggestions that the Department of Justice, as well as the addition that ODOT has requested, are ones that are necessary for us in Oregon. I will just note that Mr. Honeycutt, I believe, has already handed out the Oregonian article today regarding various states that are taking the same type of steps that we're asking this committee to take. That article also ran in the Register Guard, which I saw in this morning's paper, and it is very, I think, interesting to see how many state legislatures that are still in session are actually voicing their concerns as to what the Supreme Court's decision was and the impact
that most of us as individuals feel was overstepping the rights of private property owners to see that their property could in fact be taken from their use and actually be transferred to another private property owner for their interest. And that's why I'm here, to make certain that we do in fact protect, I think, the simple principles that we all cherish, that we have certain rights as property owners, and at the same time we recognize that there may be a time for a public purpose to allow for the government to step in and take steps. But what we saw that happening, and from my perspective in New London, Connecticut, was way too far, and that we need to make certain that our citizens are not faced with similar type of actions by any local governmental entity.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Honeycutt.
Thank you, Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of House Bill 3505 and the -3 amendments. Two points before I walk the committee through the bill. Number one, you're not alone, as Senator Brzezinski said, and as the article that I handed out to the committee from the Oregonian makes clear, there are a number of other states, majority of states, in fact, at this point, that are considering doing something to address the decision of the Supreme Court in the Kelo case. And there are a number of other states, and they're listed on the third from the last, or fourth from the last paragraph, that already have protections for property owners from having their land taken from via condemnation from themselves, and then subsequently turned around and handed to another private citizen or corporation who would presumably make some better use of the property. So you're not alone. There's much interest across the country in doing this, and I think 3505 addresses the issues in a thoughtful fashion. The other point that I want to make clear, and I think what the committee needs to understand, is that this is a very narrow situation. This doesn't occur very often. The only time that this situation will arise is when you have an unwilling seller. You've got a seller who, for some reason, the Kelo case being a prime example, does not want to sell their property. There's an inability to reach an agreement with whoever the private developer is, or with the local government, and so they're at odds, and at that point the local government or the developer, typically the local government at the developer's request, would institute condemnation actions. That's the only time that this particular legislation would be implemented. Otherwise, if the property owner can reach an agreement with the government or the private developer, then they are certainly free to sell in the free market, just like any other transaction. So this bill only applies in a very narrow set of circumstances. What the bill does, as drafted, essentially creates a primary purpose test for the condemnation of property, the primary purpose not being defined in the legislation, so the key becomes, what does primary mean? What the court would do in that circumstance is simply rely on the dictionary definition of primary. And so essentially what we're talking about, and this is one of the issues that the Attorney General raised in his letter, what we'd be talking about then is a situation where the main interest in the condemnation would be for some type of public ownership, maintenance, occupation, and use of the property, as opposed to essentially the government acting as a broker and flipping it from private citizen A over to private citizen B because private citizen B can't buy the property in the free market. And so the primary purpose test is the essentially the guts of the legislation. That's section 2, sub 1. Sub 2 then contains exceptions from that. Exceptions where even if you have an unwilling seller, the condemning authority, state, local government, can nevertheless condemn private property and turn around and give it to another private citizen. And those exemptions are contained in sub 2A through E. sub 2A being what we refer to, or at least what I've been referring to, as true blight. You have an area that truly is blighted by any stretch of the definition. This language that you'll see in sub 2A lines 11 through 14 is almost identical to the language that was in statute until 1979 and used by governments in this state until 1979 when the legislature broadened the definition of blighted area to the point where, as one of the state senators in the Oregonian article said, the statutory definition of blight in Illinois is broader than the Mississippi River at its mouth. I would say that the statutory definition of blight in Oregon law is broader than the Columbia River at its mouth. It's very broad. I could draft findings. Senator Brozanski could draft findings on behalf of the municipal government that would allow for the city of Lake Oswego, for example, to be a blighted area. And so, under the existing statutory definitions, the definition of blight is so broad that urban renewal projects and condemnation of private property from citizen A to citizen B can occur anywhere with very limited protections and for almost any particular purpose. This measure, sub 2A, limits that only to true blight situations where you have, say, a drug house or a neighborhood that's with substandard septic or sewage problems or what we would consider to be a slum area. Sub B, which is lines 15 and 16, prohibits or allows condemnation from a private citizen and transfer to another private citizen in those cases where the purchase of the property occurred after the formation of the urban renewal area. The idea there is that we didn't want to allow speculators to come in after an urban renewal area was formed, buy the property from the Widow Jones, knowing that the urban renewal area had been formed and this was the linchpin property in that particular area, and then turning around and holding the local government hostage under the theory that they couldn't use condemnation to get the property. So if the urban renewal area has been formed, somebody who purchases after that purchases essentially with the idea that because the urban renewal area has been formed, their land may be subject to condemnation and subsequent transfer to a private party. Sub C is lines 17 and 18. That would be amended by the -3 amendments. Essentially what that applies to are fixtures that are part of a condemnation of some type of building or property by ODOT. Subs D and E are also concerned with condemnations by ODOT for road improvements, and so they've been exempted out as well per ODOT's request, and I certainly think that's reasonable. And of course then Section 3 is the emergency clause. To be frank, this isn't a black and white issue. There are arguments, and you'll probably hear arguments from the league that makes sense. That there are situations where you may want to condemn, where there are truly valid reasons for condemning property from one citizen and turning around and giving it to another. However, we have drawn the line, and I think we need, it's certainly my philosophy, and I hope it's shared by the committee, that the existing system we have just simply doesn't do an adequate job of protecting private property owners, and we have to take that line and bring that line back to the point where the condemnations that occur if property is being transferred from one private citizen to another only occur in very rare circumstances, those listed in the exemptions here. And we've tried to do that, and I think ultimately we have a bill that draws the line in the appropriate spot, and certainly one that I would hope that the committee would approve.
Thank you. Representative McPherson, question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to compliment the panel on stepping back and taking a fresh run at this problem with a statute rather than a constitutional amendment. I think that was a very constructive shift in approach rather than putting something in sort of in a hurried way at the end of the session on the ballot in front of the voters, I think was not a positive way to try to advance this, the concerns here. Focusing in on this statutory change, then I have some questions here, and I'll direct them to Mr. Hunica, because it sounds like you've been most into the guts of the drafting, but feel free, others, to chime in as appropriate. Like the constitutional amendment we were looking at earlier, this still focuses on taking a property under eminent domain for with a subsequent conveyance to a private party. And it looks to me like, conveyance, I think, is a very broad concept, and the interest in the property that's being conveyed, it seems to me, is very broad. That is, it refers to condemned property or of an interest in condemned property. And so, for example, that would include a leasehold. So if a larger facility were being taken by eminent domain and then a portion of it were leased out to a private party, I assume that that would be a transfer or a conveyance to a private party. Is that what's intended?
Vice Chair Boquist, Representative McPherson, yes. And in that situation, then you would focus again, the court would focus again on the primary purpose for the taking. What is the primary purpose for the taking? We didn't want to, and we kicked around Legislative Council, Senator Starr, myself, we kicked around the idea of drafting some type of percentage requirement rather than using the term primary purpose. But at that point, there are situations where maybe you've got a 40,000 square foot public building and you've got a 10% requirement, then you can presumably under that take 4,000 square feet of that and lease it to Burger King to operate a Burger King within the public building. But a percentage, a number, didn't seem to us to be the best test, the primary purpose test, although it certainly is not as clean and clear as a number as we thought was a more appropriate test than trying to put in a number and then every session have somebody come in and say, well, instead of 10%, it ought to be 11, or instead of 11 or 10, it ought to be 9, or what have you.
Okay. Another question, if I could. And what's the timeline that's contemplated? It looks to me as though at any future time, a piece of property that was taken by eminent domain couldn't be conveyed, say, through a leasing to someone else. I don't see anything that restricts the timeline here. Is that a fair observation?
Vice Chair Boquist, Representative McPherson, the primary purpose test would be measured at the time that the local government issued the ordinance authorizing the condemnation.
So if it was not contemplated that there would be a leasing of a portion of the property at that time, that then if subsequently a decision were made to lease, that would not be be a violation of the statute. Is that right?
No, Vice Chair Boquist, Representative McPherson. No, that the you would determine or a court, if this became an issue in front of the court, would determine what the primary purpose was, and the only way that the court could determine what the primary purpose was by relying on either on the evidence, which would include presumably the ordinance adopted by the city authorizing the condemnation. If at some point 10, 15, 20 years down the road there was a change in the use of the building, for example, this statute wouldn't apply because the condemnation would have already occurred, or maybe not have already occurred, depending on whatever the findings of the court were. But there's no way, we certainly don't want to put the court in the position of trying to figure out what a municipality may do 20, 30, 40 years down the road.
Okay. Further question, if I could.
Follow up.
Would this include a security interest in the property? That would seem to me that an interest in property would include a security interest like a deed of trust or a mortgage or other kind of financing mechanism.
Vice Chair Boquist, Representative McPherson, that certainly
That certainly isn't the intent. Interest in the condemned property would be some type of leasehold, something from fee simple interest to some type of leasehold interest.
Okay, just I want to pursue point because generally financing vehicles are interests in real estate. That is a deed of trust, which is the most common form of a real estate financing vehicle, is an interest in the property, and it allows the lender to take possession of the property if they're not paid. And so I'm thinking under this language is that no property taken by eminent domain, the acquisition of such a property, could not be financed through any kind of security interest that would allow the issuers of the lenders, in effect, the bondholders, if it was a tax-exempt bond issuance, for example, would enable them to take the property they had lent the money for.
Right. Vice Chair Boquist, Representative McPherson, you're certainly correct in your understanding of trust deeds. I think, and that's certainly not the intent of the term, an interest in condemned property in subsection or in line 9 of section 2, sub 1 of the measure. However, I guess the issue is whether or not a court would read an interest in property to include essentially nothing more than a secured interest in the property, and that would probably depend in large part on the legislative history that that you folks would create.
Okay. Further question, if I could. Looking at Blight, I'd have to say I took it at your word that probably Lake Oswego, which I happen to represent, could be described as blighted under the statutory definition that exists elsewhere, so you have a narrower definition. I think it may be a little too narrow in that it focuses on a blighted area or a slum area in which buildings and improvements are located that are detrimental to the safety, health, and welfare. One of the significant issues we have in this state, I think far more than what one would call a slum. It'd be hard to identify a place in the state that I would think would really fit the classic notion of what a slum is. But we do have brownfields, that is, properties that don't have improvements on them, but which have environmental issues. And those are ones that I think would probably, in the way we view or approach blighted properties, probably would fit the definition, and yet it looks to me like that probably doesn't fit within this definition.
Vice Chair Boquist, Representative McPherson, again, we used language that was almost identical to the, and not a change in that respect, to the language that was in statute from the early 50s to 1979. And so we didn't try and reinvent the wheel. I can't tell you whether or not between the period of 1952 or whenever the first urban renewal language was created in 1979, whether that issue was ever litigated. I certainly couldn't find any in the appellate court records, and so we may be seeking a solution in search of a problem. I don't know whether or not that, I don't think that's been a problem, but.
Right, and I think maybe this may be my last one.
Maybe in the operative clause, right?
When you say in search of a problem, it calls to mind that this is in reaction to a case that arose 3,000 miles away that has stood up kind of a national adverse reaction among the public. But when we were hearing before the proposal with respect to a constitutional amendment, I had asked the question about whether we'd really had any experience here in Oregon of this happening, and it was although you offered up some sort of might have been kind of examples in Kaiser, there really wasn't a live case that was here in Oregon. Since then, it's been called to my attention that there's a case which I haven't read, involving the Port of Umatilla, which is a leading case here in Oregon on public use,
right,
which allowed the port to condemn property that was leased then to private operators within, mm-hmm, space. Would this bill prevent the activity that was covered by the Port of Umatilla case.
Vice Chair Boquist, Representative McPherson, that depends on what the primary purpose for the condemnation was. If the primary purpose was for essentially the flipping of the property and the lease to another private company, then absolutely this bill would prohibit that. If the primary purpose was for, let's say, a development on a portion of the lot or parcel that would be owned, maintained, occupied, and used by the public, and as a secondary or an incidental effect, there would be land that would then be leased to a private citizen, then that would be allowed under this provision. And, of course, the whole thing would only apply if you had an unwilling seller. Again, I don't want to get away from the idea that we're talking about every particular condemnation.
Mr. Chair, I do want to follow up with just one aspect of that. My understanding, and I haven't read the case, but my understanding of what was going on there, and I think it's very common for port facilities around the state, is that property will be acquired by eminent domain, and then the space within it for storage of grain, intermodal transfer facilities, whatever, a variety of kinds of things that are necessary to the flow of trade will be undertaken on a leased basis. And I think that when I look at this language here, that property that is taken for that purpose and then leased to a private operator, would be a private purpose if that was, because it's the primary purpose for which the eminent domain is being undertaken, if this would block that from happening.
Vice Chair Boquist, Representative McPherson, if you had an unwilling seller and that was the only intent of the Port District to create to take a particular piece of property and transfer it to another private entity, then absolutely that would be blocked.
No more questions, Mr. Chair.
Great, thank you. Question? Dave, if you'd stay put, and I'd ask the Department of Justice to come up, since we believe we've addressed their issues, Rennell and Joe, Rennell Schenkel and Joe McNaught. But I believe we have your boss's letter in the file already, so we'll find out if this amendment addresses your issues or not.
Representative Boquist and members of the committee, thank you. For the record, Ron L. Schenkel, I am here today on behalf of Attorney General Hardy Myers, who was unable to be here. You do have his memo on the file. As stated in the memo, the Department of Justice has no position on the policy choices being made today. We're neutral. That's your job. We did point out some areas where the text may be interpreted in different manners. We appreciate the quick work of both Mr. Honeycutt and Legislative Council, who took a look at this morning, and luckily your committee was carried over and they had time to address some of these issues. I'm not an attorney. I can't tell you whether or not all the issues are addressed, but I do have one of our attorneys, Joe McNaught, with me if you have any questions.
Yes, for the record, my name is Joe McNaught. I'm an attorney in the General Counsel Division of the Oregon Department of Justice.
And the first question is, does this address the issue?
Let me just state at the outset that to echo what Ms. Schenkel said, which is to say that the Attorney General doesn't have a position on the underlying policies for this bill. His interest is in assuring, to the greatest extent possible, that the bill avoids unintended consequences. And I do think a number of the issues identified in the Attorney General's letter have been addressed either through the amendment or through some clarifications that have been made by Mr. Honeycutt here this afternoon. Of course, Mr. Honeycutt's testimony is just that of a proponent for a bill, and in and of itself, even though it's suggestive of legislative history, the Oregon court tells us that legislative history is usually only persuasive when it reflects the thoughts and decisions of the actual legislators involved. One of our principal concerns, in addition to finding out exactly what was meant by primary purpose, and it sounds like, as Mr. Honeycutt has indicated, that the primary purpose doctrine that this particular piece of legislation is intended to incorporate does contemplate incidental and ancillary private uses, and that I think takes care of a lot of the concerns that we had in that particular area. There are a couple of other concerns that we just want to highlight for the committee to make certain that the committee is making an informed choice. The one is, as we indicated, it was the use of the conjunctive and property to be owned, maintained, occupied, and used by the public for public purposes. Typically, the public, which is an issue I'll come to in a second, the public, when it comes to condemned property, might be owning condemned property, might be maintaining it, might be occupying it, or might be using it. But it might not be doing all four of those things with regard to a specific parcel. We just want to clarify or bring to your attention that is a pretty significant and high standard that's being imposed. A next issue is the word and the meaning of the word public in that section and in that sentence. Earlier in that sentence, it refers to public body. Later in the sentence, it refers to public. It's not clear, does that public mean members of the public, public body, because certain instances we identified or the Attorney General identified in his letter, you may have an instance where a public body may own something such as a toll road, but a private concessionaire may be maintaining and operating that toll road. Is that something that under these circumstances is meeting all four of those conditions and being used by the public? We just want to mention that. Finally, with regard to the conveyance, we identified that as an issue and leases potentially being a problem. One of the scenarios that we highlighted was the public housing scenario, where a public housing authority may condemn property with the intent of building public housing upon that property to be rented or leased to low-income families. Under this proposal, it appears that the use of condemnation for such a purpose where leases, i.e. the leases of the individual units to the low-income families, may be precluded. Otherwise, in the changes to Section 2, the revisions address basically the issues raised by us, with the exception of one statute, which is another ODOT statute, which is ORS 366-230, which is a statute that currently allows ODOT in a situation to where they're condemning property. For example, they're condemning a farmland to put a road across it. The farmer has fixture on the property, i.e. a barn or a grain elevator or something that he can move to an adjacent parcel. ODOT, to make this whole thing work with the permission of the farmer who's being condemned, can make arrangements to condemn a small amount of adjacent property to move the grain elevator or barn or whatever over to that property. We raised that as an issue as to whether or not that was an intentional omission. That has not been addressed here. That's, again, a policy choice for the legislature.
Thank you, and I think Mr. Honeycutt wants to respond. But before that, just for the record, Mr. Honeycutt came up to present the bill, which, of course, has been brought forth to this body by Senator Starr and Senator Prezansky and myself. So I think he's accurately depicted for the record the interpretation of the way it stands today. So, and with that, Mr. Honeycutt, you want to respond?
I do, for a point of clarification, going back to the term used by the public, that it would be Section 2, Sub 1, Line 7, the use there has to be by the public rather than public body. Using public body there simply wouldn't work, because a park, for example, property is condemned for a park. The park isn't just used by the public body, it's used by the public. Public body is a subset of the term public. The government belongs to all of us, so a public body would be a subset of the public, but the public wouldn't be a subset of public body. And so the phrase used by the public is appropriate and the only one that would work there, simply because there are certainly condemnations where you would not have you wouldn't want the property, the use limited just to the public body itself. You'd want them to be, you'd want the use, or the use is going to be made by the public. The question, are some or all leases to private parties precluded? Yeah, I think I answered that with Representative McPherson. The answer to that is yes. At the point the lease to a private party becomes the primary purpose for the taking, then absolutely it would be precluded. One of the examples is the public housing requirement. The public body intends to condemn land for constructing publicly owned housing, which would then be leased to private low-income parties. Under these provisions, if you had an unwilling seller, that would not be allowed under this bill. The second example, of course, if you had a willing seller, it wouldn't matter. The second example, you've got a public office building where some of the floors, something less than the majority of the space, will be leased to merchants. That certainly, I believe, would be allowed under this bill, because the primary purpose would be something other than creating retail space for Costco or Walmart or Burger King or whoever it is that you were taking the private property from. And then the omissions section of Attorney General Meyer's letter, sub 4, the fixtures language and the inclusion of timber crops, topsoil, and gravel is included as part of the Dash 3 amendments if the committee chooses to adopt those. I think you'll address that issue. ORS 367-818 is also included in the Dash 3, so I think it takes care of that issue. And 366 or 367 or 366-330 that allows ODOT to condemn property. They condemn property for a roadway and displace a business under, I believe it's 366-330. They can then condemn property, some other property from a private citizen, and move that displaced business or property owner under that property. That is excluded from this bill, and was certainly done intentionally under the theory that two wrongs don't make a right, and condemning from one, you're already condemning from one private citizen to condemn from a second private citizen to help out the first person that you condemn property from is not something that at least from our perspective would be something that would that we'd like to see happen.
And it actually stimulated a further question. When you said
shut up.
Used by the public, and what about a prison, for example? I mean, that's not, it's hard to call a prison used by the public.
Absolutely. Well, Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, there are certainly some members of the public that make ample use of the prison. Repeatedly. We believe that the term, that the public body is subsumed by the public. In other words, a prison, which is certainly owned and operated by the public body, is used by the public, the public body being essentially a portion of the definition of the public. It's one and the same. However, it's certainly the public body is a port, is not the public includes the public body, but the public body doesn't necessarily include the public. I hope that makes sense.
I'm not sure I follow that distinction closely, but I don't, let's move on. There's one more question of part of the string of modifiers here or verbs is owned, maintained, occupied, and used by the public. The maintained, you know, oftentimes it's our public buildings and facilities are we contract out the maintenance of them. And so would I'm concerned about maybe that being prohibited by this bill, and that is a property taken by eminent domain couldn't have that component of private maintenance being performed.
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, if the primary purpose of the condemnation of the building was to create jobs for a private maintenance company, I would agree with you, but we've got to assume that the primary purpose for the condemnation will be some type of, let's say, a prison. And the fact that the prison is maintained by a public or by a private company instead of by the employees of the state certainly doesn't make that the primary purpose for the condemnation use of the property.
Okay, well, I'm not sure I see that as clear, but I won't pursue it any further, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Anything further, McKinney, committee members? And you've all testified, I assume.
Yes,
I wasn't
sir.
Here. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We have Michelle Beister, John Fletcher, and Eugene Schoenheit. Is it Schoenheit?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities. Certainly, the comments provided just now certainly do a bit to illuminate some of the concerns that we bring forward to in our written testimony. However, we do believe that there may be some implications for other entities that may not be readily apparent when you first consider this particular piece of legislation. I think, as we've heard, condemnation is rarely used in Oregon, and it is viewed as a last resort by city officials. It's a serious and sensitive matter, and city officials are very hesitant to use that authority. Occasionally, it does become necessary, however, to balance providing a public benefit for the larger community with the individual rights of a property owner. So it's in this context that we bring these concerns forward to you. I think we've already heard a lot of discussion about what is meant by primary public purpose and the conjunctive and versus or, so I'm not going to take up a lot of your time with that. However, some of those implications that I referred to earlier, for example, preventing some kinds of privatization where it might make sense, could be a potential impact of the bill as it's written. For example, I know that we do have a couple of utilities, municipally owned utilities, that contract out their operations. And to the extent that they have to do a condemnation to provide some of that infrastructure for the broader public, we wonder if that might be called into question. I think there was a brief discussion about real estate speculation in terms of the possibility of driving up the cost of property, and therefore that exemption in Section 2 of the bill as it relates to urban renewal areas, and we're very happy to see that. It doesn't necessarily eliminate that possibility, though, that if you're the last lone holdout, there may be some incentive to staying because you can perhaps exact a price for your property that is higher than market value might otherwise allow. In terms of road and utility rights of way. I think there's a situation that comes to mind with regard to pieces of remnant property, as we like to refer to it. Oftentimes you'll, well, I shouldn't say often, because again, this doesn't happen often, but in some circumstances, the municipality will condemn an entire parcel, even though they only need a portion, and then they are left with whatever's left over and no way to put that back on the tax rolls and into productive use under this legislation potentially. And so that is a concern. And I think you've heard about the intentions of this bill with regard to economic development, but I would like to point out that more and more often what we see in terms of economic development in the state are examples of public and private partnerships. I think a good example of that is the Salem Conference Center. You have a private hotel that is attached to a public conference center, and these are the types of projects that may not be amenable or allowed under this particular piece of legislation. And I think those are becoming more and more common as we try to utilize scarce public dollars and scarce public resources. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. And lastly, just as a point of information, I think there are still condemnations that can occur that are non-government condemnations that property owners might still be subject to, and this bill does nothing to address that. And maybe that's a policy decision for, you know, this committee to make, but I certainly wanted folks to be aware that that's still a possibility for property owners out there. So with that, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Chair Krieger and members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Fletcher. I'm the legislative liaison for Housing and Community Services Department, and I'm here for Director Bob Repine, who was here earlier but had to leave for an important meeting and wasn't able to stay for the length of this hearing today. And I'm here to present the department's concerns about some of the things that have been mentioned, just to echo some of the things the Attorney General's office mentioned with respect to public housing and the requirement in the current language that the public body own, occupy, maintain, and use the property could raise issues for public housing projects. Certainly in our state, the need for affordable housing, low-income housing, is an important public concern, and the provision of those projects is a public use, or at least in the public interest. It's not necessarily the same thing as transferring property to another private citizen. There are public interests involved that are wider than that, and the current language of the bill could mean that not-for-profit charitable or social service entities, including those that provide affordable housing, mental health, drug and alcohol treatment, or other services, may be precluded from using developments that are built or from acquiring developments or participating as partners in the acquisition or development of these projects. Currently, a lot of these projects are joint partnerships that work across a broad variety of organizational types, including government, nonprofit, and sometimes private entities. But these are public concerns that we feel are important, shouldn't be missed. We've made some considerations for ODOT and their particular public needs. We think the committee ought to reflect on some of the other public housing needs also, and perhaps consider clarifying language in some of the areas that has been mentioned. We do appreciate the efforts to protect private property, personal property rights, and we encourage further work on the bill to make sure that all the public interests that you would like to see preserved indeed get preserved. and that we don't unduly impact our most vulnerable low-income citizens by affecting their public housing. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. I'm Eugene Schoenheit, private citizen. I've come down here just to testify, put my two cents in, and just, you know, try and point out a couple problems I see with this bill. In Oak Grove, or I should say our Oak Grove Water and Sewer staff or boards basically have a concern about this bill, and they're worried about whether this applies to public versus private land. They're worried about whether it applies to, say, Clackamas County trying to take over, you know, use it as a method to take over other county service groups or service districts. So looking through the bill, I didn't really see that, but then as I started to study it further, I noticed that on line 6, it talks about property, and the term property is basically undefined, and the problem, and I can see where a problem comes up, that maybe this term should have been private property, you know, that way it would exclude, you know, say, any public property, you know, under this bill. And most people just, you know, it's just, you know, that's what we're talking, we're really trying to talk about here is private property, not public to public. And I think this would alleviate their concern. The second point I have is that the history of working, oh, say, with the light rail and urban renewal districts and what we've seen in our area is that anything, the definition of slum or blighted areas can just apply it to just about anything. And I think Dave Honeycutt pointed out, he said, well, it's the definition is as wide as the Columbia River. I'd like to say the definition is as wide from the Columbia River to south of Ashland. I mean, it covers everything in the state, and it's more or less just open to interpretation. I mean, this building here could be considered, you know, blighted, simply because it doesn't, you know, meet standards, personal standards, say personal standards of a government, personal standards of handicapped or whatever. I mean, you know, for whatever reason, a government entity could come out and say, well, it's an old building, I don't like it, it's, you know, blighted, so let's put it in an urban renewal district and, you know, let's replace it. So that's another problem I have with this bill. I mean, it bill basically, you know, covers everything. Now, just looking over the bill and considering that it covers everything, my opinion is that everything from on this bill line 10 down should be scrapped, because it's just, you know, the exceptions. And the reason it should be is because if you look at condemnation, if you look at the taking of land, most of it, I would say about 99%, is going to happen, say, with urban renewals or, you know, districts of that type. The taking of land is just, you know, not going to happen outside of, you know, special, you know, districts. That most of it's going to be within the special districts, you know, after they're created. And the last concern I have is the bottom of the bill is listed as an emergency. And my question would be, what is the emergency? You know, what piece of land is out there that needs to be condemned or taken over because there's an emergency? I mean, what's wrong with the process of just doing it like you do normally with bills, that it goes to the governor, eventually goes to the governor of this, and is signed and becomes law within 90 days? I don't see the emergency. Also, I handed Brian Boquist a list of my concerns. I hope you all get them. I didn't know if I was going to be able to stay and testify today, but luckily I did. So, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, committee members. Any questions or comments?
Well, actually, I do have a question for Michelle Deister, it relates to how cities use condemnation. It reminds me of a conversation that I had this last weekend with the mayor of Lake Oswego when I asked her about, mentioned this bill was going to be coming up, and she said, well, we don't do condemnations. And then she paused for a moment and she said, well, except for friendly condemnations, meaning when the party wants their property taken by eminent domain. And I think what she meant by that, I think the reason for it, although I'm a little rusty on this, is that there are certain tax benefits that occur as the opportunity to reinvest proceeds tax-free can depend upon having something taken by eminent domain, so that this would be an obstacle to getting, I think, to getting favorable tax treatment for a property owner if the power of eminent domain couldn't be used as a variation on a negotiated purchase. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, that is a comment that had been brought forward by some of our stakeholders as well, that there is some favorable tax treatment. Basically, it's a postponement of capital gains in certain circumstances when there's the possibility of a property being condemned. And in certain circumstances, there may be some property owners that might want to take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Anything further? Okay, thank you, John. Farm Bureau, Tim, come up, and AOC, Bill, come home.
We popped around.
We've done everything except these two here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Bernasek, General Counsel of the Oregon Farm Bureau, and I apologize for not having written remarks for you today. I just simply, things are going faster than I can keep up with, but just want to be very, very brief, and just a lot of the issues have been covered in depth, but just to express Farm Bureau's strong support for House Bill 3505. We represent a great deal of landowners in this state. Many of our landowners are very close to urban boundaries, and we have a lot of times dealing with legitimate condemnation, I guess, or of private property, our farmers' property, for truly public uses, and we're very concerned with the Kelo case when it came down that would maybe open up a new avenue for the taking of our property for private use. And so we just very strongly urge you to support this bill, and with that I'll just close my comments and be open for questions if you have any. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. I believe you have my testimony in front of you. I will summarize this, but I do want to make two or three points and try not to duplicate points that have been made earlier. The exercise of the power of eminent domain by counties for the purposes of acquiring property for public roads, for county parks, and for other public purposes is set out in ORS 368.096 and 203.135. And the process for that authority then is set out in the Oregon statutes under Chapter 35, as it is for all condemners. Counties do not normally use the power of eminent domain or condemnation to establish public roads or other public facilities. If it is possible to acquire the land through dedication or negotiated price, since condemnation not only requires judicial proceedings, but often results in a higher cost to the county. Even if the award is no greater than the amount offered by the county to the owner, the cost of the proceedings are added expenses to the county. However, I think as you've heard earlier, this is an important tool when there are no other options available for counties or public entities to use to acquire property for public purpose. You have heard testimony this afternoon on the issues in subsection 1 of section 2 from the Attorney General's office. I would only just add that we have the same concerns, share the same questions and the issues that were raised in that opinion. Subsection 2 of section 2 provides, as you have heard, exceptions to subsection 1 for certain condemnation actions. Among those being actions by the Department of Transportation for the acquisition of property for rights of way and other purposes. We would suggest that this exception should be extended to counties' condemnation authority that I referenced earlier in 203.135 and 368.096, which authorize similar actions on the part of the counties. And I've attached a copy of those ORS references for your review. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, let me say this, that we are concerned that the bill in its present form could create some serious unintended consequences. As a result, we would urge the committee to delay action on this bill and instead defer it to an interim study to allow more time to consider these important aspects. Committee members, I'm sure, may recall that the 2001 legislature asked the Oregon Law Commission to study the matter of eminent domain. The commission authorized the creation of an eminent domain work group to address ambiguities in the existing condemnation statutes and to look at several law reform areas with regard to the power of eminent domain. The work group spent several meetings and months working this through the 01-03 interim and brought its recommendations to the legislature in the last session. And I think many of you remember that those bills were processed through and there was a major rewrite of the statutes dealing with the power of eminent domain. We would urge you to consider using the Oregon Law Commission and reactivating the eminent domain work group to review these provisions in 3505 and bring their recommendations to the next legislative assembly so that it would be consistent with what was done previously by the legislature and in the revision and the reform that was previously done in 03, and make sure that issues that have been addressed by the Attorney General and others are not unintentionally imposed here upon local governments. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I do have a question. You talked about a work group, interim work group. You talked about reporting to the last legislative session. Did anything happen the last legislative session?
Yes. In the last session, there were several bills enacted. And I can provide the committee that information that dealt with a rewrite of Chapter 35, actually consolidated what was in two different chapters of the ORS, Chapter 35 and Chapter 281, brought those together into a totally rewritten, revised, updated section of law, which is now contained in ORS Chapter 35.
I might comment the fact that with the recent Supreme Court decision, I think it lends itself to putting every mayor, county commissioner in a position of being approached and having pressure applied for favors, and I think it lends itself to skullduggery. And I am not going to have a work group. We are going to move a bill. We may move a bill today. Unless someone can convince me that there's a couple people in this room that by Monday you will give us a word tweak that allows us to get what we need to protect Oregonians' property rights, which were obvious to us that the court has ignored. You can't do that. We're going to move a bill today. So, committee, if you want to question these two gentlemen, I do want Mr. Honeycutt to come back up for just a moment. Any questions of these two people?
I just have a question to make sure I understand the county position as it pertains just to this bill. I mean, the intent of this bill is to protect private property from being taken by a government entity and used for private use. And you raised a whole litany of issues, which I fully agree. You've got to have roads and parks and so on and so forth like that. That's not quite the issue. Is the county position they still want to have the authority to take private property from one private individual and give it to another private individual? I see apples and oranges here, so I'm a little confused.
That's not the primary purpose, and I think it centers on that definition. And again, that was helpful in hearing the testimony earlier about what is intended by primary purpose. But you would realize that on occasion that when a county condemns for a road right-of-way, they may take a parcel that is more than necessary for the improvement that is intended simply because of dwellings or improvements on the land. And so when the public road is completed and the public purpose is project is completed, there are situations where there are portions of parcels that remain that need to be disposed of, that it's not logical to retain those in public ownership, but just some way to get those back on the tax rolls, either by negotiating a price with abutting property owners, or if it's a buildable site that ends up being remained, you know, making that available at a public auction, but getting those properties back on the tax roll. Now, I think that this could be said that the development of the road is the primary purpose, but there is a taking of property here that could end up back in private ownership, being sold back to private ownership that wasn't necessarily used totally for public purpose. Is that, are you following me?
Well, as everything else, all issues are as clear as mud. So it does answer the question, but I mean, the key thing here is you know, we're trying to protect the private property, and the court is always going to interpret, you know, what is the public purpose, and, you know, we already discussed the issue of do we use 51%, two members were out, and it was determined that setting a percentage doesn't work. The one thing I think is key to point out of the bill here is that we're talking about a public body having the ability to condemn property only if the primary purpose for taking the property is to allow that property to be owned, maintained, occupied, and used by the public for public purpose, not for the public body, but for public purpose. And we've already heard testimony, and we know that there's different legal definitions of what the public body can do and what public purpose can do. Now, I'm much of the chair's persuasion here. You know, if we have to change and or to give a little flexibility or something, that's fine. But, you know, we're going to do something. And this bill started out more than 10 days ago, I believe. Senator, several weeks ago we started discussing this. Senator Persansky's back there. And so it's not that this process hasn't gone along, and it isn't that various entities of government haven't come to me and I've said, well, you know, we need to get all this stuff and start moving. So we're on a tight timeline. And if this is the 75% solution, then it's the 75% solution, and we're going with it, unless there's going to be an 85% solution in the next day or two.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Boquist, I would like to work with you because I think there are some ways that we can improve that, and the reference to using the term or instead of and is one way. Another way we would request, if you'd look at the current statutes dealing with the county's authority to exercise the power of eminent domain, we would propose that those also be included in the exceptions from subsection 1, so that counties could continue without concern about being jeopardized by the subsection 1 provisions in situations where they are clearly condemning for a public purpose, but there is maybe an incidental or a remnant of the condemnation that does not ultimately end up in the public investment or the public project. I think if we could parallel these county references with those in subsection 2, that would certainly take care of some of the concerns.
Just a comment, Mr. A road, a park, a public purpose, anything I can think of the five counties I have do is a public good issue. I mean, they're not in urban renewal and things like that. And so, I see that as apples and oranges. I'm with you on the and or the or, and how do you clearly define the public, that one clause. But I just don't see the county roads issue and stuff. And I think, another legal opinion or ask Mr. Honeycutt to come back up and re-clarify that whole paragraph would be helpful, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any members have any comments, questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Mr. Honeycutt, could you come back up for a minute? And Senator Provansky, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave Honeycutt. Dealing with one issue at a time, changing the and to an or in section 2, sub 1, line 7, I believe would gut the bill. All that would be required then is a showing by ordinance that the property would be one of the four purposes of the property is the primary purpose. So, for example, the condemnation of land by the government with the continued ownership by the government and a 99-year lease to the subsequent private developer would qualify under if you change the and to an or. So we would our organization would certainly object to changing the and to an or. Nothing in this, to respond to one of the earlier witnesses' questions or concerns, nothing in this bill expands the scope of condemnation authority. So to the extent that you can have a city, county, state condemned from a district, a special district, I don't know whether that's authorized or not, but this bill doesn't change those factors one way or the other. And while the definition of blight in subsection 2A may not be as narrow as some folks would want, it's certainly much narrower than the existing definition of blight in the urban renewal blighted area in the urban renewal provisions of Chapter 457. Senator Przanski and I talked just briefly before you called us up here, and Senator Przanski, I'll let him speak for himself, but Representative McPherson had a issue and asked me a question in sub 2A with the definition of blight dealing with the brownfields. I think it was a brownfields issue. Again, we use the 79 definition, but there certainly, I think, we certainly wouldn't object, or I certainly wouldn't object to amending that definition to take care of that particular suggestion, or the interest language, the interest question, trustee, the security interest question that Representative McPherson had in section 2 sub 1 on line 9 of the bill. If we can do that here, Mr. Chair, if that's the desire of the committee, we could, I assume, do that on the Senate side, if that's the desire of the committee.
I think what I'd like to do is have the two of you get together with the counties, and I've asked Representative Flores to kind of sit in and work with you to make sure we guide you kind of in the direction, make sure people are on board. And if you can come up and address some of these issues, taking into consideration the dialogue you've heard here today to get us where we need, and see if you can have, at the very least, the conceptual wording for us by Monday, and preferably by Monday, Tuesday, the actual amendment.
Chair Krieger, be happy to do that. I just want to point out to the committee, I think I could say with almost 100% certainty, there's no way that we'll be able to come up
with, I believe, a agreement that has the support of the of all of the interested parties to this particular piece of legislation, unless we may water it down to the point where it really doesn't do anything at all. And so we're certainly willing to work with everybody, but I don't think we're going to get to the point where we can all come up and sing kumbaya to you.
I think we need to restate the fact that the Supreme Court decision at the federal level has put us in a position where we actually have to do something. And we are going to do something, and we better do the best that we can. And if they want to be part of the process, then come to the table with some reasonableness. Otherwise, they're going to get run over. Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the hearing work session on 3505. I want to do this one here real quick and then go on to this one here. Okay, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1018.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 1018. A comes to you from Senator Brown. It modifies the qualifications for term of office of court lawyer of the state of Oregon. Clarifies the court must be a significant body, must have a significant body of published work and agree the conditions and terms of the appointment. It would reduce the term from 4 years to 2 years and also limit you to two consecutive terms. No amendments, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Committee members, we've heard this bill. I don't think there was any real problem with it or any opposition. There was no opposition testimony. I'd like to take a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1018 to the floor with a due pass.
Okay, Representative Barker has moved Senate Bill 1018 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, you will call the roll, please.
Representative
Barker? Aye.
Representative
Goldberg?
Aye.
Representative Corrin?
Representative
McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Well, 1018 moves the floor with a due pass, and it will be placed on the consent counter. Close the work session. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1037.
Mr. Chairman, member, Senate Bill 1037B was heard on the 15th and the 18th. The bill formalizes the process for ballot measure 37 claims and as well as the judicial review process for those claims. And it specifies that a new claims process, judicial review will apply only to claims filed after the effective date. It also authorizes tract of record dwellings under certain circumstances and has an emergency clause. This bill has a referral to the Committee on Budget. You've received previously the fiscal impact statement. We also have received, and you should have in front of you, the dash B-25 amendments. I believe Representative Grudd will be speaking to those, and we also have Dave Honeycutt here available to speak to those if the committee do that.
Representative Grudd, if you'd like to go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Bill Garrard, District 56, Klamath Falls, and Chair of the House Land Use Committee. Senator Ringo, Mr. Honeycutt, and myself met yesterday afternoon, and we could not find points of agreement in regard to producing a document for this committee that was acceptable to all parties. As a result of that meeting, the decision was made to recommend to the committee that you accept the dash 25 amendments which were written by the authors of Measure 37. The dash 25 amendments clarify Measure 37 in regard to ownership, transferability, claims process, judicial review, the appeal process, authorizing state agencies to waive state statutes. And this amendment also would delete the tract of record provision contained in SB 1037. If you liked Measure 37, you will love the dash 25s. if you didn't like Measure 37, you will not be a happy camper with the proposed amendments. It is my feeling that the members of the legislative body have waited patiently for this major issue to come to the floor of the House, and that the members deserve the opportunity to debate and hopefully vote on this issue. I would ask for the adoption of the Dash 25s, and you're moving this bill to the Budget Committee.
Thank you. Committee members, you have comments, questions?
I do have one question, just Mr. Boquist. I just have one point of clarification, because I'm skimming back through here to ensure that the family member clause in here is intact and kind of where it's supposed to be in regards to inheritance of, you know, from father to daughter, father to son, so on and so forth, and that clause is in here. Mm-hmm.
Chair Krieger, Vice Chair Boquist, yes, it is in here.
Thank you.
Sure it is.
Any further comments, questions?
For the witness, we don't have a motion as yet, right?
No.
Okay.
I guess you're free.
Thank you.
They let you off awful easy. I think before I take a motion, you know, this has been an ongoing dialogue in the Senate. Obviously, there's a complete different philosophy on what the intent of Measure 37 was between different parties, and I can understand that. But they've had the debate on their version and how they felt regarding the issue in the Senate. And as Representative Girard testified a few minutes ago, we feel we have that obligation to give our people on this side the same opportunity.
And a motion on the bill? The amendments?
Mr. Chair, I move the A25 amendment to SB 1037.
Ruby Boquist has moved the A25 amendments into Senate Bill 1037. Any discussion?
Objection.
Well, Mr. Chair,
B25.
I don't want to belabor the point, but it is, as I think it's fairly predictable. I mean, I won't support the amendments nor the bill going forward in this way, and just to kind of sort of map where we are generally, we have a wide spectrum of belief about what ought to happen in response to Measure 37, and the Senate took a run at scaling back to something that was a consensus bill that could draw support together. I think they, by including the tract of record provision on and including it within the procedural provisions, they went a little too far in terms of trying to get to something that could be a consensus product. But what we have here is kind of retreating into one extreme, and it's just whether you think that's a positive contribution to what ultimately has to be a common ground kind of process. So I don't happen to think that that's a constructive way of getting us to that middle point. Other people may disagree. They think that this is a desirable procedural maneuver to get us ultimately there. But of course, the version that's before us here, I could not support.
Okay. No, we take note of that. Any further?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I don't see the Senate bill as a consensus version, so.
Okay. Anything further? Okay, the amendments to be adopted.
Motion. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 1037 be as amended to the floor with a due pass
to the budget.
To the Budget Committee. I see there's a referral.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 1037B with the, I guess it's the Dash 25s, to the Budget Committee. Any further discussion, objections? Call the roll.
Representative Barker?
No.
Representative Boquist?
Yes.
Representative Flores?
Yes.
Aye. Representative McPherson?
No.
Aye. Senate Bill 1037B, as amended, is moved to the Budget Committee. It will not need a carrier there. And I believe committee members were done until tomorrow. We got a couple bills that have been held over. Close for the day. Thank you for your time.